Actually, most people don't spend quite that much every week.
These numbers do not add up.
The new series of More or Less, with me, Tim Harford, starts next Wednesday morning at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 30th of August. Good morning. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Michelle Hussein.
The headlines this morning: in her first broadcast interview of the US election campaign, Kamala Harris has defended her shift in stance on key issues, insisting she kept her word and will continue to do so.
The most important and most significant aspect of my policy perspective and decisions is my values have not changed.
Workers could be given the right to ask their employers to work a four-day week under government plans to increase flexible working.
Also in today's programme, the hope of pauses in the fighting in Gaza to allow children to be vaccinated against polio. We'll report from the Lake District, where there's alarm over days of untreated sewage discharges close to Windermere.
You can see it floating, but there's a lot of money being spent and nothing's being done about it.
Our focus on shoplifting continues as we hear from a retailer and again from the man who did it for years.
People who shoplift are ill and that's why they're doing it. There's always a choice, but it doesn't feel like you've got one when you're that desperate. I feel like I didn't have a choice.
And Gary Oldman on playing Jackson Lamb as the unusual spy thriller Slow Horses returns.
The sort of slightly shady, dirty side of espionage. It's your PG Tips, Tesco's version of it, I guess.
The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Kamala Harris has used her first broadcast interview of the US election campaign to set out her vision for what she would achieve if she becomes president, promising to turn the page and offer a new way forward. Speaking to CNN, the Democratic candidate outlined several policies and defended her shift in position on key political issues. With her analysis, here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
Kamala Harris's apparent reluctance to give an extended broadcast interview meant this event assumed an exaggerated significance and placed her under even greater scrutiny. Initially, she struggled to lay out what she would do on day one of the job, talking very generally about creating an opportunity economy and trying to lower the cost of living. Asked about recent policy U-turns, Ms. Harris said her values have not changed, before confirming she no longer supports a ban on fracking for natural gas or decriminalising illegal immigration. Donald Trump posted his verdict to his social media site in one word: boring.
UNICEF says a campaign to administer polio vaccinations to around 640,000 children in Gaza will be an immense challenge, but that it is possible. Israel and Hamas are said to have agreed to a series of three-day humanitarian pauses to allow the programme to take place, after a case of polio was confirmed in the territory for the first time in 25 years. Ricardo Pires from the UN Children's Agency says it's vital that action is taken as soon as possible.
The polio virus is very contagious and it could spread to neighboring countries and communities that are not fully vaccinated. So it's a public health crisis that we're dealing with right now and a situation that we haven't seen in a long time in terms of urban warfare. So it's not an exaggeration to call this one of the most dangerous polio immunization campaigns in history.
Employees could be given the right to ask to work a four-day week under government plans to encourage flexible working. People would then compress their contracted hours into longer days. But ministers insist they won't impose the change on staff or businesses. The SNP's autumn conference gets underway later today. It's the first time the party has come together since it lost 500,000 votes in the general election and was left with 9 MPs at Westminster. Dozens of parents have told the BBC they feel their children are being failed by private special schools. Local councils in England spent £1.6 billion last year on places for pupils at these schools. Concerns have been raised about a lack of qualified teachers, poor academic progress and an overuse of restraint. But the National Association of Special Schools says they provide a vital education for children with complex needs. Ruth Clegg reports.
Parents have told us they battled to get their child in a private special school, paid for by their local authority, only to find out it was unable to meet their needs. And the complaints process was often impenetrable. In one case that ended up in court, the judge ruled an autistic teenager had been restrained unnecessarily and her school didn't fully understand her disability. There are 800 independent special schools across the UK, and the specialist support they offer helps many children to flourish. The government says the special educational needs system needs urgent reform.
Untreated sewage has been discharged into sites that flow into Windermere in Cumbria continuously for 7 days. The water company United Utilities said the overflows were designed to work during heavy rainfall, but campaigners say the system should have been able to cope with the recent weather. The mother of a 13-year-old girl who died after suffering a severe allergic reaction to a hot chocolate bought in a Costa coffee outlet has called on the government to do more to raise awareness of food allergies. Abby Dweely says no parent should have to lose a child in such circumstances. Tim Muffett reports.
Hannah Jacobs had a severe dairy allergy. In February last year, she visited a branch of Costa Coffee with her mum, Abby, who ordered 2 soya hot chocolates. But after Hannah took a sip, she had a severe anaphylactic reaction and died shortly afterwards. Hannah's mother has now called on the government to boost allergy awareness. She wants labels specifying allergens to be made compulsory in cafes and restaurants, and for widespread training on the use of EpiPens to be introduced. Costa Coffee said it was in the interest of everyone to understand what happened, and it would carefully consider comments made by the coroner in Hannah's case.
Paralympics GB are second in the medals table after the opening day of competition at the Paris Games with 2 golds, both in the swimming pool. 19-year-old Poppy Maskell set a new world record to win the women's S14 100-metre butterfly, while Tully Kearney claimed victory in the S5 200-metre freestyle. Tennis, Carlos Alcaraz has been knocked out of the US Open by the unseeded Dutch player Botik van der Zandschulp. 2 British players, Dan Evans and Jack Draper, have both made it through to the next round.
Thank you, Jane. 6 minutes past 6, time for the weather. Here's Simon Kidd, morning, Simon.
Good morning, Nick. The weather looks pretty settled, actually, through today and indeed into the start of the weekend as well. We've got a big area of high pressure moving its way in. So it means that for most of us today, actually, it's going to be a dry day with some sunny spells. But let's put a little bit more detail on that for southwest England, southeast and eastern England, where we've got a few mist patches around this morning, but it's actually clear for most of us with some sunshine. Now, during this afternoon, we'll see some fair weather cloud developing, but still some lengthy sunny spells and temperatures of 21 to 24. Degrees. For Wales, the Midlands and across northern England, again a bit of mist and some hill fog out there this morning, but there is going to be lots of sunshine and again fair weather clouds building up at times during the afternoon, maximum temperatures of 18 to 21 Celsius. For Northern Ireland, the fog and the mist is a little bit more extensive here, but that's going to clear fairly quickly. There'll be some dry weather with some sunny spells and again perhaps a little cloudy for a time later this afternoon with highs of 17 or 18. And across Scotland today, again it's mist and fog across southern Scotland in particular, whereas in northern Scotland there are 1 or 2 showers, but those will clear away. Mist and fog clears, sunny spells expected all day with highs of 14 to 18. Now through tonight it's going to turn quite cool actually beneath clear skies, 6 or 7 degrees in northeast England and Scotland, 11 to 15 degrees elsewhere. And throughout Saturday there will be more cloud moving its way into southeast England, and that's going to spread further north and west during the morning into southwest England, the South Midlands and across East Anglia. Some showers in southwest England later on as well. Sunny elsewhere with highs of 17 to 22.
Simon, thank you very much. 6:08. Now let's have a look at the papers. Many of the front pages featuring reaction to news that the government is considering curbs on outdoor smoking. The Metro says pubs have labelled the idea bonkers. Has Sir Keir sounded the death knell of our pubs? The Express asks. The Guardian says the Prime Minister is on a collision course with the hospitality sector over the plans. The head of the JW Leese Brewery, William Leese-Jones, is quoted as saying the idea was a bolt from the blue and has not been discussed with the industry. But the paper goes on to say health experts and the public back the measure.
On its front page, The Telegraph says workers are to get the right to demand a 4-day week. The paper claims that under the plans expected to be outlined by ministers this autumn, the balance of power is to be shifted, with companies legally obliged to offer flexible working from day one, except where it is not feasible. A Labour source is quoted as saying it could help productivity. The Conservatives tell the paper businesses will be left petrified.
The main story in The Times is the plan for the NHS to go into offices companies and workplaces in England to weigh and measure people as part of a drive to improve the nation's health. The checks are for the over 40s, and there's a particular focus on getting men to come forward as they're traditionally more likely to avoid going to the doctor. The story is also in the Daily Mirror, which dubs the scheme the Middle Age MOT.
The Sun reports that Princes William and Harry both attended the funeral of their uncle, Lord Robert Fellowes, yesterday, but the paper says they were not seen talking to each other. The relationship between the brothers has been strained since Harry and Meghan chose to step back from royal duties. The paper says the pair sat separately at the back of the church at Snettersham in Norfolk.
The Mail leads on Sir Keir Starmer removing a portrait of Margaret Thatcher from a study inside Number 10 after apparently finding it unsettling. The painting was commissioned by Gordon Brown and unveiled in 2009. The paper says some Conservative figures have called the move petty.
Several other papers have picked up on research which says people who catch up on lost sleep at the weekends, do you manage that, Michelle? I'm not sure I do, may potentially lower their risk of heart disease by up to 20%. The findings, which were presented at the European Society of Cardiology, used data involving more than 90,000 adults in the UK. The British Heart Foundation is quoted in The Telegraph saying the report demonstrates the importance of getting at least 7 hours of sleep a night. The Mail says this research should put to bed the argument of whether extra sleep is good or bad for you. Well, we can keep trying.
Yes, any opportunity to catch up on that. I can't believe extra sleep is bad for you. Surely not. Anyway, finally, The Guardian says that for many, no Christmas is complete without a Terry's chocolate orange, but the makers are being accused of messing with perfection after announcing a spin-off. There is to be a plain milk chocolate version of the ball. The manufacturers say it's part of their plan to move beyond orange, but the paper says fans of the original product have been left asking simply why.
I'm not asking why, but I'm asking what will it be called? I mean, if it's a chocolate but it's not orange,
yes.
Is it the Terry's chocolate?
Yeah. Yes,
doesn't
true.
Work. Doesn't
point.
Work. It's
good
11
point.
Minutes past six.
For the last 7 days, untreated sewage has been released into waters that flow into Lake Windermere. United Utilities, the company responsible for water services in the northwest of England, says that it is because of heavy rain. Mairead Smith, our reporter, has been to see what's happening. Describe then first what you saw, Mairead.
Well, I did see a very high level of water at an area known as Cunsey Beck. So that is a river that runs into Windermere. It's north of the lake. And I was at the wastewater treatment works at near Sorry. So the pipe in question, the CSO, combined sewage overflow, that is responsible for the discharges there, was actually in under the water. So obviously can't see that up close. But the figures do show, and they are on the public domain, that that CSO has been spilling an overflow of sewage for the last 7 days. And campaigners say that it's just not acceptable. But there has been heavy rainfall in that area.
And that's essentially the heart of what United Utilities is saying, isn't it? They wouldn't do an interview with us on this, but they have released a statement. Although this is a lot of days, I mean, 7 days in a stretch of this. Is that normal in these circumstances?
Well, they argued to me when I spoke to them yesterday that this was normal, that it is what is permitted within the law. That storm overflows, they are designed to operate whenever there is heavy rainfall. And we all hear that phrase, exceptional circumstances. But campaigners are questioning, well, what is the definition then of exceptional circumstances? What makes it OK for these CSOs to operate? But they did say that this year, August, has seen more rainfall than in any other month and is the fourth wettest of 44 months since January 2021. So that's a lot of numbers to take in. The facts are, they say, that there has been heavier rainfall in August, and that is why river levels are so high, the ground is so saturated, and these CSOs have to operate.
Mairead Smith, thank you.
13 minutes past six. What will the government in Scotland cut to fill the black hole in its budget? That's just one of the difficult questions facing the SNP as they gather for a party conference for the first time since the general election, in which they lost 38 seats in Westminster. We're joined by BBC Scotland's political correspondent Andrew Kerr. Morning to you, Andrew. Let's start with the budget. Difficult. We now know what John Swinney, the First Minister, won't do. We don't know what he will do, do we?
Good morning, Nick. That's right. I mean, we've had some little crumbs of trails. Nature funding will be cut. Off-peak travel fares will no longer be subsidised. No free travel for asylum seekers. But we're being softened up for what will be really significant cuts across all government departments. We're told this is going to be really bad. The Finance Secretary, Shona Robertson, will make her statement to Parliament on Tuesday, setting all this out. Perhaps we've not quite seen the likes of this before. Now, John Swinney, the First Minister, is blaming high inflation, high public sector pay deals. He's also blaming what he calls Labour austerity, says these pay deals have not been funded properly by the UK Labour government. Labour have been hitting back, saying the Scottish Government have been mishandling the nation's finances. And in fact, the Scottish Fiscal Commission, the independent watchdog, have been saying that actually the Scottish Government is largely to blame for the state of the nation's finances.
This was going to be a difficult party conference even without all that, wasn't it, given how bad the election was for the SNP?
Terrible party conference, Nick. You'll remember those huge gatherings in the recent past when Nicola Sturgeon would be standing up before hundreds and hundreds of people, a much smaller affair in Scotland's capital this weekend. I mean, they were down to 9 seats at the general election in July. The first thing on the agenda, an internal behind-closed-doors session on the state of the party, on the what happened in the election, the post-mortem. That will be led by John Swinney. They hope to get that sorted out on the first day and then try to turn things around again, because it's another huge electoral challenge, perhaps even more significant for the SNP, and that is the 2026 Holyrood election, where they hope to retain power here in Scotland.
Andrew Kerr, thank you. We're going to be talking to Shona Robertson, the SNP Cabinet Minister, later in the programme.
60 minutes past six now. The UK needs to encourage more risk if we want to see tech startups grow and stay here. More on that in our business news with Will Bain.
Morning. Yeah, that's right, Michelle. Something we've talked about quite a bit in this slot, isn't it? Risk, appetite for it, how we encourage it and how we do it safely. It's something that Cathy Wood, the founder and chief executive of ARK Investment Management, one of the world's leading tech investors, has been chatting to us about. This is a US firm that's famed for its investment in a lot of the kind of cutting edge innovation companies, things like AI. In particular, she felt the UK needed to trim regulations to try and encourage investment in firms like that and encourage them to stay listed on the stock market in London too. But first, the shares in the chipmaker Nvidia fell again over Thursday. I asked what was concerning investors in technology firms right now.
ChatGPT really lit the space on fire, the AI space on fire. And so there's been a huge amount of investment dollars going into the space. And this usually happens at the beginning of a massive new transformation in technology. And it takes a while for everyone to figure out, okay, how do we put this to use? The same thing happened with the internet. And of course, the internet was transformative. We think the same is true of AI. We've had a huge amount of investment in hardware. Now we've got investors asking the question, okay, where are we going to see this come out and generate new revenues and increase earnings? And we think that will come. It's just we're at the very early stages.
What do you make of the UK as a place to invest in the type of companies that you specialize in investing in?
Well, some of the greatest companies have come out of the UK. DeepMind, Googlebot, I think that's the premier AI company in the world. Arm Holdings came out of the UK. So your educational system is exemplary. And yet I think what happens is your capital markets are not deep enough, or maybe incentivized enough. In the US, we're big advocates for tax incentives for innovation, encouraging founders to take risks, stock-based compensation plans, option plans that are tax advantaged. So I think the ground is fertile in the UK. Certainly you've produced some of the finest companies in the world when it comes to innovation. I think though policy measures could address some of these issues. You know, it's interesting to have gone through the regulatory backdrop in the US, which recently we've experienced more restrictive regulations when it comes to blockchain technology than you have in the UK with just one financial regulator. We have six financial regulators who vie for regulatory power. And so we've seen a lot of talent move away from the US into London, Berlin, Stockholm. And again, it's a regulatory arbitrage opportunity that countries have. If you can give innovators more streamlined regulations, have a tax system that encourages innovation and doesn't penalize failure as much, then I think the ground is fertile in the UK.
I mean, there can't be a more political CEO right now in global business than the CEO at Tesla. Do you ever think, oh, this is more hassle than it's worth?
You know, we just stay focused on the technology. We have in one company.
Is that easy to do with a company like that?
Oh, it is.
When there's so much noise around it and so much noise around one individual at it.
And this has been the case since we took our position in 2014. So what we always say to our investors is we are looking at the technologies. What we have in Tesla is not an auto company. This is a robotics company, an energy storage company, and an artificial intelligence company rolled up into one. It is probably the best example of the convergence among technologies that is taking place today and that is going to help scale into massive opportunities. We think that globally, the autonomous taxi opportunity is an $8 to $10 trillion opportunity from almost nothing today. If Tesla is in the pole position, this probably will be one of the highest valued companies, if we're right, on autonomous technology in the next 5 to 10 years. And so we just say to our investors, keep your eye on the prize. We're going to make sure that Tesla is number one in the technologies. That's our role. And there's a lot of noise. And sure, I'm sure it's dissuaded some people from buying a Tesla car. But in our view, the best technology is going to win. The company that gets people from point A to point B, the safest and the fastest in an autonomous taxi or a robo-taxi, is probably going to win the lion's share of that market. And so just keep your eye on the prize.
Cathy Wood there, the founder and chief executive of ARK Investment Management. Well, Laura Lambie is with us, senior investment director at Investec. Laura, morning.
Morning.
On the UK investment point that Cathy Wood was making there, what did you make of that?
Really interesting that she mentioned the sort of tax breaks that entrepreneurs get in the US that we don't have to the same extent in the UK. The kind of fear of failure, the penalising failure that we have in the UK is perhaps stopping entrepreneurs from progressing. A different culture, and perhaps, you know, that's something that the government, you know, could be listening to and wanting to address, because it's policy measures that may well help.
Touch on NVIDIA. We talked about it quite a bit on the programme yesterday, but shares continued to fall yesterday. What was your sense as to why?
I suspect it's just a short-term positioning. It's rather than a change in fundamentals for the company. The key messages were fairly upbeat regarding demand for its products. And that really needs to happen to underpin the massive amount of capital expenditure that the company is making. But the potential for generative AI to impact every function of business, as your previous guest, Cathy, was alluding to, it is just massive. And NVIDIA, and as she said, Tesla, could well be the big beneficiaries of this.
On the stock market here, news from Shell cutting its workforce, and it looks like it's trouble once again in its offshore wind division.
Yes, it said it's going to cut 20% of jobs in its exploration and strategy. And I think this is on the back of their newish chief executive promising to cut operating expenses by $3 billion over the next few years. Now, that's $3 billion out of $40 billion. Results at the start of the month were ahead of expectations, fairly strong growth in upstream marketing. And, you know, one can only expect that profits may well improve if they can manage to get their operating costs down.
Laura, thanks so much for your time. Laura Lambie there, senior investment director at Investec. Now, a government consultation ends today on how to tax the dealmakers working in private equity. Carried interest is a share of the overall profits of a private equity fund. Since the 1980s, HMRC has treated it as a capital gain rather than income, meaning it attracts a lower rate of 28% when it's taxed. In its manifesto, though, the Labour Party, now the government, of course, called the arrangement a loophole and have promised to close it. Michael Moore is Chief Executive of the Private Equity and Venture Capital Association. That's the trade body for the private equity industry. Michael, morning.
Good morning, Will.
The obvious first question seems to be, this is how most of these people make their money. How is it not income?
This is based on a long-term investment. Our industry, just listening to your previous speakers talk about the need for capital to be put into the economy, to invest for the long term, take risk and grow businesses. And that's exactly what private equity and venture capital do. And across the UK, there are over 2 million jobs now that are in businesses backed by private capital. When you hold these investments for the long term, typically up to 10 years in a fund before the value is realized, you have to grow those businesses substantially. You have to hit benchmarks that beat the public markets and everything else. And only then do you get carried interest, and then it gets taxed as a capital gain because demonstrably the businesses have grown and are much more valuable, and in the process of that will have created more jobs, innovated, taken risks and been in a much stronger position than before.
But other areas of financial services, people are taking risks, investing in companies or projects, and are being taxed at almost double that rate.
Where the difference is that our industry buys companies, makes, you know, invests in them, brings in external expertise, and does that over a substantial period of time. We're not buying companies and selling shares in them quickly and regularly. We're not earning bonuses. We're actually creating value in those businesses over the long term. There's risk here. It is none of it is guaranteed. And only if the benchmarks are hit, does the carried interest get awarded, and then it gets taxed. There are, I don't like admitting this, but there are plenty who don't hit the hurdles which will earn them that carried interest. So this is something that requires a lot of application, a lot of capital over a long period of time.
And the consultation closes today, as we say. What's your sense, what's your fear, I suppose, happens if changes are made to this system?
I think we've been encouraged that the consultation focuses in on the fact that here in the UK, we have the largest hub of private equity and venture capital expertise anywhere in the world outside the United States. There are 140,000 people in the UK, invested $20 billion last year. The government has said it wants to sustain this world hub. That's very encouraging. And they also recognise we are in an internationally competitive situation. The capital and the people need to be attracted to and retained in the UK.
It's long overdue to be looked at as a system, though, isn't it? I mean, what's 37 years since this thing's been changed?
well, it's 37 years since it started. It is routinely and regularly looked at, and rightly so. And just to be clear, where the returns to individuals are, it should be treated to income, whether it's interest or dividends or fees or whatever, that is already taxed at income tax. What we're talking about here is the return on the capital gain that the whole fund, so pension funds, endowments, everybody has made in the course of that 10-year fund. So that is the difference. And we are pleased to have it looked at. The key thing is that it is taxed on a basis that is internationally competitive.
Michael Moore, the Chief Executive of the British Private Equity and Venture Capital Association. There's a mouthful at 6:30 in the morning.
You made it. Will, thank you very much indeed. 28 minutes past six. The sport and the cricket, Gary.
The cricket, Nick. Yeah, the second day of the second test between England and Sri Lanka at Lord's. We'll see England resume on 358 for seven. Joe Root was the star of the show yesterday, scoring 147. And Jonathan Agnew reports.
The former captain was at his best yesterday, salvaging his team from possible embarrassment at 192 for five and then making batting look very simple. He blocked 12 balls on 99 before sliding a four through third man to equal Alistair Cook's record. It seems certain, given Test cricket's current direction of travel, that when Root finally retires, his run tally will never be beaten. The miscued ramp shot that resulted in a catch in the gully on 143, two overs before the new ball, seemed unnecessary. And while Atkinson played very promisingly for his first half century. The rest of England's batting was disappointing. Self-inflicted dismissals accounted for all but Brook, with Pope's ill-judged pull shot on one taking to 38 the percentage of his test innings that haven't lasted 20 balls.
Test Match Special takes to the air at 10 o'clock this morning. On the opening day of competition at the Paralympics, Britain won 6 medals, including 2 gold in the swimming pool. Poppy Maskell won the 100 butterfly and Tully Kearney the 200 freestyle.
I'm a bit speechless, to be honest. I really wanted redemption after Tokyo. I wanted to go and get the gold. I didn't want a silver again. I didn't want a bronze. But with everything that's happened this year, I didn't know if that'd be possible. So, yeah, I'm just really, really happy with that.
Chelsea have qualified for the next stage of the Europa Conference despite losing 2-1 to Servette, but both Kilmarnock and Hearts have been eliminated from Europe. The US Tennis Open in New York, Dan Evans reached the third round with a straight sets win over Mariano Navone, and his performance was matched by Jack Draper, who also won in straight sets against Diaz Acosta. Katie Bolter has been knocked out. And golf, we featured the British Masters yesterday on the programme just to tell you that England's Paul Waring has a 1-stroke lead at the Belfry. Tyrrell Hatton is 2 strokes behind.
Gary, thank you very much. Tomorrow, Radio 4's series Profile returns.
Each week on Profile, we get to know the people who are making news headlines.
Beyonce took 4 private voice lessons a week. She would sit outside my door with her feet up on the wall.
Hearing from those who know them intimately.
First time we properly spoke was in the library, and he let me go in front of him in the queue.
Tucker's very handy. He would fix up the motorcycles and we would sell them.
She's always been there to roll up her sleeves and speak truth to power.
The new series of Profile. That's what I call proper fame. On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Starts tomorrow night at 7.
And the subject tomorrow at 7 is the writer of Sherwood, indeed the prolific playwright, James Graham, TV writer too, of course. It is now 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Lassane and Nick Robinson, and Jane Steele's got a summary of the news.
The US Vice President Kamala Harris has given her first interview since replacing Joe Biden as the Democratic candidate in November's presidential election. Speaking to CNN, she said the US was ready to turn the page on Donald Trump and promised to bring down the cost of essential goods, invest in small businesses, and create more affordable housing. Mr. Trump criticized her performance, saying she didn't look like a leader to him. UN agencies are preparing to start a mass polio vaccination programme in Gaza this weekend after Israel and Hamas agreed to a series of 3-day localised pauses in fighting. It's hoped the deal will allow hundreds of thousands of children in Gaza to be vaccinated. Government plans for flexible working could see people being given the right to request a 4-day week and continue to receive full pay by compressing their hours. A Conservative MP has claimed businesses are petrified by the plans, but ministers have insisted the change would not be imposed on individuals or companies. The SNP's autumn conference gets underway later today. It's the first time the party has come together since it lost 500,000 votes in the general election and was left with 9 MPs at Westminster. Dozens of parents have told the BBC they feel their children are being failed after securing council-funded places at private special schools. They cite a lack of qualified teachers and an overuse of restraint. The National Association of Special Schools says they provide a vital education for pupils with complex needs. Untreated sewage has been discharged into sites that flow into Windermere and Cumbria continuously for 7 days. The water company United Utilities said the overflows were designed to work during heavy rainfall, but campaigners say the system should have been able to cope with the recent weather. The mother of a teenage girl who died after suffering a severe allergic reaction to a hot chocolate bought in a Costa coffee outlet has called on the government to do more to raise awareness of food allergies. 13-year-old Hannah Jacobs, who had a severe dairy allergy, collapsed and died in February last year.
Jane, thank you very much. The time is just after 6:30. Kamala Harris was on the airwaves in the US overnight in her first interview since becoming the Democratic nominee for president. She did the CNN interview with her vice presidential pick, Tim Walz, beside her. Our correspondent in Washington, Jenny Kumar, was watching.
I would say there were no big breakout moments. I think she came across as calm and confident. She was obviously well prepared. She answered all the questions you would expect her to be asked. She answered them well. Now, she has faced a lot of criticism for flip-flopping on issues, but her response was that since she's been vice president, her position on things like fracking haven't changed. And she's insisted on this line that actually her values haven't changed as well. And probably for me, one of the most standout moments was a question she was asked around Donald Trump recently questioning her identity as black. And it was probably quite striking because the response was probably the shortest answer to any question in the interview. And she said, same old tired playbook. Next question, please. Mm. So a conscious decision not to engage in his personal attacks.
But is this sense that her values have stayed the same and her views and policies haven't changed entirely credible? For example, if you look at the border, the fact that she used to talk about immigration detention centres being closed, and yet she was prepared to support the border security deal that would have completed Donald Trump's wall with Mexico.
I think she'll still continue to face questions on her record on the border. And I thought what was quite interesting as well was she didn't shy away from the what she said were achievements of the Biden administration. In fact, she pretty much embraced his legacy on all sorts of fronts, including immigration. What we've seen is pressure from the Republicans to do a live interview, to face media scrutiny. I don't think that will go away. I think they'll feel this interview wasn't really challenging. And we have had some response from Donald Trump. He has basically said he's looking forward to the TV debate and has said that Kamala Harris has changed every one of her long-held positions on everything. So I think the next big test will be that big set-piece moment, the TV debate. And only a couple of months ago, we saw just how potentially influential a TV debate can be in shaping the race for the White House.
Jenny Kumar in Washington, thank you.
It's now 25 minutes to seven. Is the government going to give give workers the right to demand to work a four-day week as part of their long promised package of workers' rights? Our political correspondent, Leila Nathu, has been looking at what we know, what is beneath the headline in the Daily Telegraph this morning, which states that workers will get the right to demand that four-day week. Morning to you, Leila. What do we know then?
Morning, Nick. Well, the short answer is yes, but it's not a four-day week in the sense of getting a paid day off. It's the idea that workers would be able to ask for compressed hours, so working full-time over fewer days. So that's quite a kind of typical flexible working request. And Labour have been quite clear for some time, long in the making, these plans to try and strengthen workers' rights. And as part of that, they want employees to be able to ask or to be offered flexible working in various forms, whether that's part-time or this idea of compressed hours from the get-go. So we've got a bit of a kind of sense of the political rows that are going to come down the track when this legislation gets brought forward this autumn. Parliament, of course, is returning next week. And I think we're seeing the kind of attacks that the Tories are going to go with on this, very much framing it as business on one side, unions on the other. I mean, Labour, for their part, would say, look, we've done a lot of work over the years. You know, these plans have been years in the making to try and get businesses on side. But there's still been a bit of back and forth. There was a meeting only this month between Angela Rayner and the unions and business groups too. So there's clearly a lot of wrangling still going on about exactly the extent of this. But certainly the idea from Labour's point of view is that flexible working would actually increase productivity, perhaps get people back into the workplace who currently aren't, if they have the opportunity, for example, to work their hours over fewer days. But I think this, the way that it's being presented gives you a flavour today in the Telegraph of what we're going to hear from the Tories presenting this as an anti-business plan.
They will no doubt say it's enough to have Margaret Thatcher spinning in her grave. She will not, though, be looking down from a room that was named after her, the study in Downing Street. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is a portrait that of Margaret Thatcher that has been hanging in Downing Street. And it apparently, according to Tom Baldwin, who's a biographer of Keir Starmer, wrote a very hefty book detailing him. And according to him, he had a conversation with Keir Starmer about this picture in the room that it hung. And Keir Starmer agreed that he didn't like it and that he was going to take get out of that room. And he's since confirmed that he said that it's actually hanging somewhere else in that building, or at least it plans to. So Keir Starmer clearly moving around the artwork in number 10 as he finds his feet there.
Found it unsettling, we're told.
Apparently.
There we
are. I mean, interestingly, if you cast your mind back, Keir Starmer had written an article some time ago sort of praising Margaret Thatcher as a leader. But anyway, clearly now he's got in there and doesn't like that particular portrait.
Leila Nathy, thank you.
Coming up to 20 to 7, we are 2 days into what's been described as the biggest Israeli operation in the occupied West Bank for years. Israeli officials have been speaking of evacuating civilians, which, to Palestinians, sparks fears of never being allowed back to their homes. Lucy Williamson, our correspondent, is in Jenin, which is in the northern part of the West Bank. What can you tell us, Lucy, about the extent of the operation currently?
Well, we're now heading into the third day, as you said, of this operation, which has spanned several cities in the northern West Bank. We're told that the Israeli army has now pulled out of Tulkarm after its operations there. Severe damage to the camps in Tulkarm, especially Nur Shams. They've also pulled out of Turbas previously, but it now seems that Jenin, where we are, is the likely focus of this operation. And I'm just looking out towards Jenin refugee camp. I don't know if you can hear the Israeli military drone above me, but we've had a lot of gunfire and a big explosion here this morning. Some suggestion that the army may have been shooting to try and set off IEDs in the area. But there's been a lot of activity overnight here. Yesterday, the army were in the eastern part of the city, and they've also been going through the eastern villages of Jenin. And in the village of Sababda overnight, the special forces were told surrounded one of the houses there. The IDF's, the Israeli army, says they were trying to capture what they called a terrorist cell. The people inside the house escaped in a car, and which was then hit apparently by an airstrike, an Israeli army airstrike. Very difficult to tell exactly what's happening because there's no sign of the people in the car. The bodies appear to have been taken away by the army. So we're waiting to hear more details about that. But it does seem as if Jenin today may well be the focus of this operation.
And what does it mean for civilians in these areas?
It's very, very difficult. Yesterday, not only were large parts of the city blocked off, there was no access to Jenin refugee camp in the west or those eastern neighbourhoods on the other side, but also the Palestinian communication networks were down. So it was very difficult for people inside the camp, for example, to know what was going on even a couple of blocks away. Very difficult for people to call ambulances if they need them. Very difficult for ambulances to get through to people if they needed to. We stood outside the hospital, which was also surrounded, one of the two hospitals surrounded by the Israeli army, and the ambulances were all being checked coming in. They had to stop, open their doors, show to the people inside the Israeli jeeps what was inside. So there's a high level of control and, as I say, communications moving around impossible for many people in the city.
Lucy Williamson in Jenin. Thank you.
It is 19 minutes to 7. Let's take a look at the front pages, what's making news inside the newspapers as well. The fallout of the debate about the smoking ban gets quite a lot of coverage today. The Express asked the question, has Sir Keir sounded death knell of our pubs, on the front page of The Guardian. A similar question, Starmer risk clash with pub firms over plans for outdoor smoking ban, it reports, saying he's on a collision course. The paper points out that, however, YouGov polling carried out yesterday showed that the public tend to support the plan, with 58% of people saying they backed the idea against 35% who did not. That, says Fraser Nelson, star columnist in the Telegraph, says is the problem. In other words, he says that the public don't care enough about their liberties and that that was demonstrated during lockdown. Indeed, recent polling suggested that 45% of people still want compulsory masks on public transport. Nightclubs closed, 29% back that, and 23% want to bring back the rule of six. Extraordinary figures. And this, he points out, after Sir Keir stood outside number 10 promising to tread more lightly on your lives. He argues that if you can do this on smoking, why not action to stop alcohol, fizzy drinks, bacon and life's other guilty pleasures.
The Eye has an exclusive on its front page. Details it says it can reveal about meetings held by Tommy Robinson, whose real name is Stephen Yaxley-Lennon, revealing an inner strategy of the far-right figure's attempts to canvass support for a campaign against British Muslims. Under the banner UK Against Hate, Robinson proposed getting members of the Sikh, Jewish, Hindu and black communities together in a movement against Islam in the UK. Any campaign would not mention Muslims directly, only implying the criticism by discussing recent terrorist attacks and jihad on the streets of the UK. But the paper says the details obtained by them expose how Robinson tried to garner support from varying religious groups and communities in the UK and mobilised football hooligans in an attempt to launch anti-Muslim rallies across the UK. This month, he's announced plans for a patriotic rally in Glasgow in September, saying this will remain a peaceful protest to share our distrust and fear of the future. And in July, thousands marched alongside him in what he declared was the biggest patriotic rally in the country.
It is now 16 minutes to seven. Our main news this morning is Kamala Harris has given her first broadcast interview since becoming the Democrats' US presidential candidate and has defended her shift in position on key political issues. Now, the far right could be on the cusp of winning the most votes in German state elections for the first time since the Nazis. Yesterday, Germany's ambassador to the UK was here in the Today programme studio, highlighting this weekend's regional elections, which are being held just a few days after a knife attack in Germany fuelled anti-government feeling, in part because the man detained for that attack is a Syrian asylum seeker, a suspected Islamist. The AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, looks set to come out on top in these two elections. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reports from one of the Länder, one of the German states, Thuringia, to find out why people are prepared to support a party routinely denounced as extremist.
Herzlich willkommen in Jena, Olaf Scholz.
Boos cut through a polite applause for Chancellor Olaf Scholz. He's on stage in Jena, Thuringia's second city. This state is a stronghold for the far-right Alternative for Deutschland. Scholz has not been very visible during this campaign. He's not exactly seen as an electoral asset. And the reception here is mixed. An argument breaks out between a supporter of Alternative for Deutschland, Ralph, and a passionate opponent, Lennart.
Sorry to interrupt this, we're from BBC News. You're obviously having a robust discussion. I just wanted to ask, does Germany feel divided to you at the moment?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely, they say. It's the one thing they can agree on. In a town on the edge of the Thuringer Wald forest, people sit in the shade sipping beer. Various party campaign stalls have popped up here in Schmalkalden, but across much of Germany's former communist East, it is the far right now topping the polls. As sausages sizzle on the grill in this sunny market square, what's driving this discontent? Well, there's angst about a range of issues, from immigration to Germany sending weapons to Ukraine, a deep frustration with the parties that have governed this country since reunification, and a gnawing dissatisfaction about what reunification has delivered, or hasn't delivered, for the people of East Germany.
Also, auf jeden Fall, davon bin ich überzeugt, dass es Fehler gab.
Mistakes were made with the reunification. The Western system was forced on the East Germans.
Birgit's an AfD activist, out campaigning ahead of Sunday's vote. Well, some people in Germany, they're not just critical of the AfD, they say they're actually scared of the AfD. What do you make of that?
Es will ja auch keiner rechtsextrem oder wenn's auch noch geht, Nazi sein.
No one wants to be called right-wing extremist or Nazis. But the AfD has nothing at all to do with right-wing extremism. We are about conservative politics.
More arguments, this time at an AfD campaign stand in Meiningen. The AfD's classed in this state by domestic intelligence as right-wing extremist. Many view it as an anti-migrant, neo-fascist movement, even an existential threat to modern Germany. But Konstantin, a trainee car mechanic,
says other parties have failed the East.
You can constantly see where the East begins and where the West begins. Better infrastructure, better industry, it's more concentration on the West, like, and we are getting, like, forgotten.
The AfD, as you all know, faces accusations of being an extremist party with extremist people within it.
If you really see it, you see that the AfD is really trying to do something and not just saying, yeah, we do it, and then nothing changes. And it's the only party who wasn't there on ruling Germany right now. Yeah, I believe in it.
Konstantin rides off on his S50 Simpson Classic East German moped. His words are echoed by many in the East, a tale of two countries in one.
Jess Parker reporting. It is 11 minutes to 7. The SNP conference begins today in Edinburgh, which is the party's first since its Westminster presence was reduced to just 9 MPs in the election in July, and also the first since emergency spending cuts were announced, with warnings of more to come, and the Finance Secretary Shona Robertson saying only absolutely essential spending will be permitted. She joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
Prepare us then for the principles that are going to guide the next step of this that you bring in beyond what's already been announced. I know you've got a statement coming next week and then a budget.
Yes, well, of course, this has been forced upon us due to the significant austerity that has been announced by the Chancellor, the £22 billion of reduction in public spending. And of course, that has an impact on us here in Scotland and, of course, Wales, Northern Ireland. And we have to prepare for that, because in year, the Scottish Government has very few levers in order to make sure we balance our budget, which we're legally required to do. So spending reductions, unfortunately, are where we are having to look. And I'll set the detail of that out next Tuesday, and then we'll be straight into budget. But the priorities, of course, are to make sure we follow the First Minister's very clear priorities around eradicating child poverty and supporting economic growth, improving public services and tackling the climate emergencies. And those will be our guide, particularly around our budget priorities that we set out over the next few weeks.
But this idea that the situation, emergency spending cuts, difficult decisions, the idea that it's all been forced upon you, is at odds with what the official independent economic forecaster, the Scottish Fiscal Commission, has said, that much of this pressure comes from the Scottish Government's own decisions.
Well, of course, they also cited the uncertainty about the level of funding from the UK government. Now, that is absolutely critical, although I would say there has been a marked improvement with our communication with the Treasury since the new government came in to power, and that's to be welcomed. But the figures are the figures, and the Prime Minister literally stood in the gardens of Downing Street and told us that it was all going to get a lot worse and that the budget was going to be very difficult. Now, the Scottish Fiscal Commission, of course, absolutely key institution here in Scotland. We work with them very closely. And one of the issues they pointed to, of course, was pay and pay pressures. And that is something that is a big concern to us, because if a UK government is going to accept UK pay review body recommendations, we've got no argument with the principle of doing so, but then they have to fully fund those pay review recommendations. And we're not clear about the level of the funding that we'll receive
You didn't hold the line, did you, against what you had already said you do on public sector pay? You had said that only public sector pay rises of up to 2% would be affordable. And then you ended up providing extra funding to offer a pay increase of at least 3.6% to local authority workers. And as the watchdog says, that is part of what has contributed to these in-year pressures.
So we said up to 2% plus 1%, so up 3%. But of course, that's all we could afford. And I made clear at the time that anything beyond that pay policy had to be funded either through the UK government funding that extra pay awards, which they really need to do because they accepted the pay review body recommendations, or through spending cuts. I mean, we have a fixed budget, so we can only set out what we can afford. And if you look at the impact...
You do have some tax-raising ability, and indeed you've used it. So you could, if you want to continue having what you've sort of put forward as one of your USPs, that Scotland is more generous on a whole range of a whole range of areas, including free university tuition fees, if you want to continue that approach, you're going to have to raise taxes more, aren't you, to fund it?
Well, our use of our income tax powers that we have, which are pretty limited, but we have used them, and it's estimated to have raised an additional £1.5 billion for public services that we would not otherwise have if we'd followed UK government tax policy. But underneath all of this, and the Chancellor actually said this herself, is that budgets have not been reset to take account of inflation for years. So, but since 2021 and the spending outlook, they have not been reset to take account of inflation. And that has eroded billions of pounds from our budgets, not just in Scotland, but elsewhere as well. And of course, pay pressures have been driven by inflation, and that has created an enormous pressure, not just on the Scottish Government's budget. We saw the Welsh Government having to do an emergency budget last year, and of course Northern Ireland have not balanced their budget for 2 years. So we need to have a reset which recognises the impact of inflation, and we need more fiscal flexibilities across the devolved governments to be able to manage these pressures.
Shona Robertson, thank you.
6 minutes to seven. Tomorrow is deadline day for parents and carers of babies and toddlers in England to apply for free childcare for this autumn term. When the Conservative government announced the biggest expansion of free childcare we'd ever seen, Labour, along with many others, said it wasn't deliverable. But they have continued with the policy and now face the challenge of trying to deliver it. Well, can they? We're joined by Christine Farquharson, Associate Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, the public spending think tank. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
We heard from you many times under the previous government that there were real problems finding the places and finding the staff. Has anything got better?
The new Labour government has basically signed up wholesale to what the previous government had announced in the March 2023 budget. And so now we're actually, the rubber is hitting the road and we're trying to roll this out. The government's approach, both the current government and the previous, is if you fund it, they will come. So the funding rates for these new entitlements, these new childcare places, are actually pretty generous compared to the market price. And the government is hoping that's going to be enough to incentivize providers to enter the market or to expand.
Are there any signs of that? Because there are, 4,000 new nursery workers are going to be needed to deliver this promise. Any signs that they're coming?
I think it's difficult to tell. The data hasn't really come online yet. We have seen some providers say that they're able to expand and planning to expand. Some providers saying, no, not really for me, not really interested. Fundamentally, we know that there are staffing issues in the early years sector, and we know that the biggest reason for that is pay. So when the government is coming to the table with more money, with higher funding rates, with something that's more generous than what they could get from the market, the hope is that providers will be able to pass some of that along to their staff.
Now, Labour did have an idea of their own. It was to use disused primary school classrooms, because there are fewer kids of that age over the next few years, and to convert them into nursery provision. What do we know about that?
We know very little so far. The plan is to get to an extra 100,000 nursery places in schools. We don't really know the timeline for that. We don't really know what that's going to look like. Even if that is delivered, that's going to nudge the market in a different direction. But that's really only about 6% of childcare places in England. So that's not a big transformation.
So if you're a parent or a carer listening now, it's perfectly possible that you've heard the promise. Mm. But it won't be delivered, that you won't be able to get the place that you want.
It's a big expansion. And so I think at the moment that this comes in, it is a step change. And that usually does come with teething problems. Hopefully, in the longer run, this is something that will be able to be worked out.
Christine Farquharson, thank you very much indeed, of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. We're going to be talking to a minister in the Education Department, Jackie Smith, Baroness Smith, later in the programme after 8 o'clock.
It is now 3 minutes to seven. Simon King has the weather.
Michelle, thanks so much indeed. Yeah, it's looking pretty settled actually over the next couple of days. We've got high pressure moving in, so it means that for most of us it's dry with some sunny spells, but we do have a few mist and fog patches around this morning in southwest England, southeast and eastern England. That mist and fog clearing away pretty quickly. We're going to see some sunshine and a bit of fair weather cloud developing into the afternoon, but still some lengthy sunny spells, temperatures of 21 to 24 degrees. For Wales, the Midlands and across northern England, again, the mist and fog will clear. It's a mostly sunny start for the day. Again, we'll see some fair weather cloud building up in the sky from time to time and top temperatures of 18 to 21. Across Northern Ireland today, well, the fog and the mist is a little bit more extensive this morning, but again, it's going to clear pretty quickly. We will see more cloud for a time this afternoon, highs of 17 or 18. And then for Scotland, a few showers in the far north of Scotland, those are going to clear. Mist and fog in the south, also clearing. Sunny spells for most of Scotland today, temperatures of 14 to 18 Celsius. Tonight's going to be quite cool, actually, beneath some clear skies, especially around northeast England and Scotland. Temperatures down to about 5 to 7 degrees, and a few mist and fog patches into Saturday morning, which will again be a largely fine and dry day. We'll see plenty of sunshine, but in the southeast of England, cloud will move its way in here, spreading north and westward into southwest England, the South Midlands, towards East Anglia, and later on there could be some heavy showers in the southwest with a few rumbles of thunder. Top temperatures of 17 to 22. By Sunday, generally speaking, a cloudy day for most of us, and some showers in southern England will start to spread further north across the UK, with highs on Sunday of 19 to 26 degrees.
Simon, thank you.
You murdered someone?
It wasn't me.
On BBC iPlayer.
How old were you when your brother died?
I was 15.
He was released on licence.
He killed my brother.
So naturally you're friends with him online.
He served his time. What more do you want him to do?
Some things are better laid to rest.
What were you going to get out of this?
Revenge.
Dead and buried.
How does it end?
An eye for an eye.
Watch all episodes from next Monday on BBC iPlayer.
Now, talking of television to look forward to, coming up in the next hour.
Surrounded by losers, misfits and boozers.
If, like me, you're addicted to slow horses, it's coming back, and we're going to be hearing from Gary Oldman on Playing Jackson Lamb.
It is very good indeed. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Michelle Hussain. It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 30th of August. The headlines this morning. Kamala Harris has said America is ready to turn the page on Donald Trump in her first broadcast interview since securing the Democratic US presidential nomination. Aid agencies say a mass polio vaccination campaign for children in Gaza will be immensely challenging despite plans for a pause in the fighting. And workers could be given the right to ask their employers to work a four-day week under government plans to increase flexible working. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Kamala Harris has used her first broadcast interview of the US election campaign to set out her vision for what she would achieve if she becomes president. Turn the page. Speaking to CNN, the Democratic candidate outlined several policies and defended her shift in position on key political issues. She insisted her values had not changed on the topics of illegal immigration and climate change, saying she had kept her word and would continue to do so. With her analysis of the interview, here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
Kamala Harris's apparent reluctance to give an extended broadcast interview meant this event assumed an exaggerated significance and placed her under even greater scrutiny. Initially, she struggled to lay out what she would do on day one of the job, talking very generally about creating an opportunity economy and trying to lower the cost of living. But throughout the interview, she appeared calm and confident and, crucially, didn't score any own goals. Asked about recent policy U-turns, Ms. Harris said her values have not changed, before confirming she no longer supports a ban on fracking for natural gas or decriminalising illegal immigration. Addressing Republican claims that she was soft on border issues, she pointed to her previous experience.
Let's be clear, in this race, I'm the only person who has prosecuted transnational criminal organizations who traffic in guns, drugs, and human beings. I'm the only person in this race who actually served a border state as Attorney General to enforce our laws, and I would enforce our laws as president going forward.
Kamala Harris shrugged off personal attacks from Donald Trump by saying only that he was using the same old playbook, and downplayed the historic nature of a black woman running for president, saying she's in the race because she believes she is the best person to do the job, regardless of race and gender. Donald Trump posted his verdict to his social media site in one word: boring.
UN agencies are preparing to start a mass polio vaccination programme in the Gaza Strip this weekend after agreeing a series of three-day localised pauses in fighting with Israel and Hamas. The aim is to vaccinate more than 600,000 children after the first case of polio in 25 years was found in the war-torn Palestinian territory. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yulan Nell.
Ever since traces of the polio virus were found in Gaza's sewage water 2 months ago, it's been a race against time to stop the highly infectious disease from taking hold. The wars disrupted childhood vaccination programs and left most people displaced and living in crowded, insanitary conditions. Now the World Health Organization says it's agreed three consecutive three-day pauses to begin its ambitious campaign. Both Israel and Hamas say they're supporting it. With one baby in Gaza already left partly paralyzed by type 2 polio, the aim now is to reach at least 90% of children aged under 10. Each child must be given two doses of oral polio vaccine, meaning that there will have to be two rounds of the rollout, 1 month apart.
Employees could be given the right to ask to work a four-day week under government plans to encourage flexible working. People would then compress their contracted hours into longer days. But ministers insist they won't impose the change on staff or businesses. Our political correspondent David Cornock reports.
Labour came to power promising to make flexible working the default from day one for all workers, except where it's not reasonably feasible. As first reported by the Daily Telegraph, that could allow staff to work four longer days instead of five. An employee would still have to work their full hours to receive their full pay. Details are expected in the autumn when a law to create a new package of workers' rights is likely to begin its journey through Parliament. A Department for Business and Trade spokesperson insisted the government had no plans to impose a four-day working week on employers or employees. They added that the plan for more flexible working was instead designed to increase productivity and help get more people back into work.
Untreated sewage has been discharged into sites that flow into Windermere in Cumbria continuously for 7 days. The water company, United Utilities, said the overflows were designed to work during heavy rainfall, but campaigners say the system should have been able to cope with the recent weather. Nikki Schiller reports.
The untreated sewage has come from storm overflows at two water treatment plants in Cumbria. For a week, they've been discharging into a lake and river, which eventually flow into Windermere, a site of special scientific interest. United Utilities said the overflows were designed to operate during heavy rainfall, like that seen in the Lake District over recent days. But the founder of the Save Windermere campaign, Max Staniak, said such spills were only supposed to happen in exceptional circumstances and disputed that recent weather conditions fell within that scope. The Environment Agency said it understood the concerns in the community about the discharges. United Utilities said it had invested hundreds of millions of pounds to reduce the number of spills and planned to invest more.
Nominations for the leadership of the Ulster Unionist Party will close this afternoon. The Northern Ireland Health Minister Mike Nesbitt is expected to be the only candidate to replace the outgoing leader Doug Beattie. Chris Page reports.
Mike Nesbitt is set to return to the role he previously held for 5 years until 2017. He resigned after poor results in an election to the Northern Ireland Assembly. But senior members of the Ulster Unionist Party have given him their strong backing to do the job again. Mr. Nesbitt is a former TV sports reporter and news presenter. Last month, he took charge of the UUP's only ministry in the power-sharing devolved government. He's expected to keep the health portfolio when he's confirmed as leader. The UUP was the biggest political force in Northern Ireland for almost a century. But during the last two decades, it's lost much electoral ground to the Democratic Unionist Party. In July, the UUP won its first Westminster seat for 7 years.
The mother of a teenage girl who died after suffering a severe allergic reaction to a hot chocolate bought in a Costa coffee outlet has called on the government to do more to raise awareness of food allergies. 13-year-old Hannah Jacobs from Barking in East London had a severe dairy allergy. A coroner concluded that a failure to follow processes contributed to her death. Hannah's mother, Abby Dwile, wants labels specifying allergens to be made compulsory in cafes and restaurants.
We need to do better. No mother, no parent should be losing their kids like this. It's not fair. If I'm asking for something and I'm asking what's in that, all your staff should know what ingredient goes in everything. Every single person, restaurant, coffee shops, need to know.
Costa Coffee said it would carefully consider the coroner's comments. The Food Standards Agency says it is developing best practice guidance in relation to allergen information. Paralympics GB are second in the medals table after the opening day of competition at the Paris Games. They have two golds. All the details from Paul Serres.
Poppy Maskell won Paralympics GB's first gold medal of the Games, breaking the world record in the women's S14 100-metre butterfly at La Défense Arena in the French capital. Tully Kearney also took gold in the pool in the women's 200 metres in the S5 category, going one better than the Games in Tokyo 3 years ago. Elsewhere in the pool, William Ellard took silver in the men's S14 100-metre butterfly. There were silver medals in the Paris cycling for Steve Bate and Chris Lane, and for Daphne Schrager, and the doubles pair of Felicity Pickard and 14-year-old Bly Toomey won bronze in the women's D14 table tennis. There are 42 medal events on day two of the Games, with Maisie Summers-Newton, Jodie Kunde and Tully Kearney all big medal hopes for Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
Tennis, Carlos Alcaraz has been knocked out of the US Open by the unseeded Dutch player Botik van der Zandschulp. Two British players, Dan Evans and Jack Draper, have both made it through to the next round.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It is 9 minutes past seven. She's fine with an autocue, they said, but she won't be able to cope with cross-questioning about her record and her policy flip-flops. That, they said, was why she won't dare do a proper sit-down TV interview. Kamala Harris's critics said it again and again and again. Well, last night, the woman who's now the favourite to become the next US president tried to prove them wrong by sitting down with CNN. And she did so, something that's a bit of a tradition in American presidential elections, alongside her running mate, Tim Walz. But again, her critics, like Donald Trump, suggested that was to make it easier, safer for her. He has struggled, Mr. Trump, to find a way to take her on, but his most potent criticism was the focus of the most interesting exchanges in that interview, namely that what she says now about the border, about fracking, and much more besides, is not what she used to say. This was her response.
The most important and most significant aspect of my policy perspective and decisions is my values have not changed. My value around what we need to do to secure our border, that value has not changed. I spent two terms as the Attorney General of California prosecuting transnational criminal organizations, violations of American laws regarding the passage, illegal passage of guns, drugs and human beings across our border. My values have not changed.
My values have not changed, but a policy prescription certainly had. Watching that interview was Professor Brian Klass, Associate Professor in Global Politics at University College London. Morning to you.
Good morning.
The allegation of flip-flopping is as old as American politics. It is used in every American election, isn't it? She is particularly vulnerable to that charge, though, isn't she?
Well, I think the reason why that she's been accused of that is because the last time that voters heard from her directly in a not supporting role for President Biden was in 2019 when she was running for the Democratic nomination. And that's when she was trying to carve out policy positions to appeal to Democratic activists. And now she's running for U.S. president, which is a different thing. So this is a standard part of American politics where during the primary campaign, you stake out positions that are more appealing to your base. And during the general election campaign, you stake out positions that are more centrist. And that's exactly what Kamala Harris is doing.
The reason the flip-flopping charge matters and has been used over the years is it suggests candidates are either weak or they're not really telling you the truth. Now they're telling you what they think you want to hear. How do you think she did in the interview dealing with that charge?
Well, I think she did fine. I mean, I think this is a relatively normal interview, which is itself remarkable in American politics because the death of normalcy has been the story of American politics for the last decade or so. And this was just what normally happened in the pre-Trump era. You got a series of questions. You dealt with them competently. There was nothing spectacular about it. I think she is vulnerable on a few things. The fracking issue is one that is important in Pennsylvania, one of the most important battleground states. But, you know, I think she dealt with it.
Just to be clear on that before you move on, if you would. She was opposed. She now says as president she wouldn't stop it.
Exactly. So she basically carved out a position in 2019 where she said that she would ban fracking. And last night she says, I will not ban fracking as president. And I think, you know, one of the things that she tried to do was to say, my values haven't changed. So on that issue, for example, she was opposed to fracking on the basis of climate change. And during her time in the White House, she helped support the largest climate change mitigation bill ever passed in history. So what she's trying to say is that the specifics may have changed, the values didn't. Whether voters believe that, we'll have to see. But Pennsylvania will obviously be a very, very important state in November. And so this will be an issue that she will be asked about again, I'm sure.
It's been said repeatedly that Donald Trump is struggling to find a way to tackle her. He hasn't got long, has he? This debate is coming on the 10th of September. Do you think this flip-flopping, this suggestion that she's really deep down the woman we saw 4 years ago, very liberal, will be his central charge?
Well, he's been sort of workshopping insults against her, and nothing has seemed to sort of disrupt the narrative. I mean, he for a while started suggesting she was a communist somehow. He's been talking about this flip-flopping. But really, you know, what his campaign has been struggling to do is to reclaim the momentum. And what's really uncomfortable for Trump is that he has sort of become a little bit boring. People have seen this show for the last 8 years, and they know what Trump is, and she's the sort of new kid on the block. And in a way, that's a problem for a political campaign. So I don't know how the tack will change after the debate on September 10th, but that is the major opportunity for the Trump campaign to reset the race and to reclaim the momentum.
I thought in some ways the most striking thing in the interview was a non-answer to a question that she felt she didn't have to answer when she was asked about one of Trump's insults. She said something very brief and then just said, next question, as if I'm not going to deal with this guy.
Yeah, this was in response to Trump claiming that she somehow had decided to become black, which is a ridiculous claim. And I think this is something that's a hallmark of Kamala Harris's campaign, is she's not trying to make this race about her personal identity. She is parrying every question that's about her being a woman or her being an ethnic minority. And I think the whole point of that is to say, this is not about me. Now, whether that works or not, again, we'll see. But it is a marked contrast from some of the narratives that were built around Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016, for example, where a lot of the rhetoric was around breaking the glass ceiling and so on. But it's a clear political choice she's making. She's clearly trying to make this not about her personal identity and to respond to Trump's more ludicrous accusations by simply ignoring them and saying they're not worthy of comment.
Professor Brian Klass of University College London, thanks so much for joining us.
7:15 is the time. 2 months after the poliovirus was detected in water samples in Gaza and after a 10-month-old Palestinian baby girl became paralysed in one leg after becoming infected, hundreds of thousands of other children could be protected if pauses in the fighting between Israel and Hamas in the coming days allow aid workers to begin a first round of vaccinations. This is not a ceasefire, Israel's Prime Minister has emphasised. Louise Wateridge from the UN in Gaza has been telling me about their plans and what's at stake.
So the United Nations is ready to start the first round of polio vaccinations on Sunday. What we need more than anything is, of course, a ceasefire. We need safety for everybody. We need safety for the children, for the families, for the parents, the health workers, access to medicine, access to facilities. We're very hopeful that there will be humanitarian pauses. What that means is that the parties of the conflict are going to be pausing the fighting in the areas we are vaccinating the children. The campaign will be in the middle area, the southern area, and the northern area of the Gaza Strip over those coming days. And this is simply because we cannot vaccinate children under a sky full of bombs and strikes. We can't vaccinate children who are fleeing for their lives and families who are forcibly displaced.
Are you confident that there is an agreement from both Israel and Hamas for what the World Health Organization is saying, a 3-day pause in the first instance? Does that mean that there will be no fighting Sunday, Monday and Tuesday, or at least there can't be if you're going to do what you hope for?
We're very hopeful that there will be these pauses. The understanding is that they will be from around 6 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So that will be when the pause in the fighting is. I cannot tell you what military operations will happen around that. This is something we will anxiously wait to see because, of course, any military operations during the time we are trying to roll out a vaccination campaign will affect our ability to deliver these vaccinations to children, and it will affect our ability to access children.
Is it one vaccination, or do you need to then be able to reach the same children a second time?
So from Sunday, we're giving out 2 doses, oral doses of the polio vaccination. And then 4 weeks after this initial round of campaigns, we will need to repeat flu vaccination. Again, this is for 640,000 children across the Gaza Strip.
And one child has already been paralysed.
Yes, unfortunately, the first case confirmed in the Gaza Strip, this is the first case in 25 years, was recorded in a 10-month-old baby who is now paralysed in their left leg. And this is one of the symptoms, this is one of the results of polio, which is why it's so important that we get this vaccination campaign out as soon as possible and that we have the safety to do this, because the repercussions will be disastrous for not just children in the Gaza Strip, but children in the region. And they've already been put through so much. They've already struggled through so much throughout the 10 months of this war. We really need a ceasefire to put out this campaign, to give these vaccinations to children. The hostages need to go home to their families. And we need a rest for everyone. We need the end of this disease spreading, the conditions that's causing it. All of these conditions need to come to an end. We need more aid. We need to provide more to people. And that can only happen with a ceasefire.
Last time I spoke to you, you were talking about aid distribution having to be suspended because it was no longer possible for you and your colleagues to get around Gaza and for the supplies to get around Gaza. Has that restarted?
The humanitarian response here remains strangled. It's very, very difficult for us to operate. The space we're able to move in is shrinking. It continues to shrink with displacement orders, with ongoing military operations. It's as hard as it's ever been. It's not getting any easier. The humanitarians themselves are becoming displaced. United Nations organizations have been displaced from their premises and their facilities. And of course, with this vaccination campaign and with all humanitarian supplies that we need to distribute, we need more access. If we don't have access to health centers, hospitals, warehouses for distribution, if we don't have access to the aid, we cannot distribute it to the population. And this is one of the ongoing struggles we've had throughout this war.
Louise Wartridge of the UN in Gaza. Thank you.
It's now 19 minutes past seven. Average monthly mortgage payments for first-time buyers are now £150 lower than at their peak last summer. That is according to the property website Rightmove. Will's been studying the figures, Will.
Yeah, we keep looking at these and we're taking more of an interest in them, aren't we, after that first move by the Bank of England in terms of interest rates and what that means perhaps for the housing sector down the track. So this set of data, interesting also, we've had news from Nationwide in the past few minutes as well, that annual growth in house prices picked up slightly year on year as well. Let's dig through it all with Stuart Hare, Group Chief Executive for the Skipton Group. They own Skipton Building Society as well as Connells, the estate agent. So all sectors of this particular sector. Stuart, morning. Thanks for being with us.
Morning, Will.
First of all, on that first-time buyer picture, is that, as always with these numbers, is that mirroring what you're seeing?
Yes. And it's good news. It is now much cheaper because interest rates for mortgages are less expected, are smaller, and therefore mortgages themselves are less expensive. The challenge, though, of getting a house hasn't gone away. It just means for those that have managed to afford it that they can now slightly more comfortably make that move.
Mm. As I was saying with Nick, are you seeing that then? And are you reflecting that at Skipton, for example, as well? Are you moving on the basis that what you expect, more interest rate cuts through the autumn?
Yeah, so we've certainly been reducing our rates along with the market. If you don't, then you'll not be doing any business. But also on the estate agency, what we've seen is people with more confidence. So August is sometimes a quieter month with people on holiday, but actually it's up month on month. And it's up materially year on year, so up almost 15-20% of viewings, for example, and also of sales. So we are seeing that confidence in the market for those that can afford it.
This is a room with a pair of elephants in it, though, isn't it? Not just the supply issue that you talked about that still doesn't seem to be being quite tackled, but also the issue around deposits.
That's right. You mentioned both elephants, so let me just recap them. First of all, there isn't enough supply of houses in the UK, so it's good to see what the government are saying. We just now need to follow up with action of actually getting spades in the ground and houses built. That will take time. But then for customers who have been paying out on bigger rents, because rents are still going up, they want an option now to be able to buy if they don't have access to Bank of Mum and Dad. And that's where we need to really challenge ourselves as a financial service industry about whether we really need the size of deposits that we are often asking for.
Stuart Hare, thanks so much for your time. Stuart Hare there, the CEO of the Skipton Group.
Will, thank you. It is 22 minutes past seven. Let's bring you more now of our series on shoplifting. Some of you who got in touch after Jim Connolly's first report yesterday from Leeds often said that you had seen shoplifting taking place or seen it being ignored. We'll hear from a judge and a retailer before eight. But more now of what Jim has been investigating and what a man called Ross, who shoplifted for years, revealed to him.
I think I'd be a gold medalist if it was shoplifting were a sport.
Such a memorable quote from a voice we never really hear from. Ross is a shoplifter of around 20 years. He says it was all to fund a drugs habit.
I know it's in the tens of thousands.
You've stolen tens of thousands of pounds?
Yeah, I'm ashamed to say, yeah.
Ross has been convicted 15 times for shop theft, and yet he's never been to prison. He was in court recently, and we spent the day with him as he waited for his case to be heard. We saw delay after delay, and that matches the stats. At the end of last year, the open caseload at magistrates' courts stood at nearly 380,000. Eventually, Ross's case was heard, and this was him as he walked free yet again.
I mean, it's just a real big relief. I mean, obviously, I don't want the record, and I don't want the experience.
Ross was given a suspended sentence, meaning he faces prison if he commits another crime.
I am on the straight and narrow now, so I'll make sure I keep that way.
And what's your plans now when it comes to keeping clean, not getting in trouble, not shoplifting?
Well, it's a whole new life, yeah, all of the above. Just a case of filling my time with productive things, onwards and upwards.
In effect, he escaped prison. But is there really space to put people like him? We've heard a lot recently about prisons being close to full. In fact, on the day Ross was in court, this was the big debate in Parliament.
Will he at least guarantee that none of the criminals he is instructing prisoners to release early are considered high risk?
Yeah, yeah. And even if someone like Ross does go to prison, the data suggests he's likely to keep stealing. Looking at official government stats, 54% of people sent to prison for theft reoffend.
A weight of fear every day walking down the hill from where I live.
Because you thought you might get caught?
Yeah.
Ross is a drug addict of nearly two decades, and he reckons he's never been given the support he needs to kick his expensive habit.
There's always a choice, but it doesn't feel like you've got one when you're that desperate. I feel like I didn't have a choice.
There are 30,000 people like Ross in England and Wales alone, addicted to crack and heroin.
Around 70% of shop thefts are committed by somebody with a serious Class A drug addiction.
Professor Emmeline Taylor from City University says people like Ross have a huge impact on the shoplifting statistics.
And those individuals almost treating it as a full-time job in order to fund their drug habits. Sadly, the criminal justice system isn't set up to assist these people. There's no point sending these individuals to prison. It's just simply a revolving door.
Ross gave me a document when I met him at court. It was a report from a respected psychiatrist, noting that he was highly likely to have ADHD. I have it here. It reads, having ADHD and also being subject to a severely traumatic early childhood can be considered as highly significant factors that have led to a life of self-medication and ultimately addiction. But again, Ross says he wasn't given help.
If I'd have got the help, it might have been a different life.
But if we're being blunt, many people may have little or no sympathy for Ross. But the impacts of his crime affect us all. The Centre for Retail Research suggests shoplifting adds £133 onto an average household shop each year.
Tia Maria, honey, cheese, washing tablets and liquid if you can, please, mate.
You may remember that from yesterday. The daily requests he got to steal to order, all via a middleman. Which all seemed shocking until he revealed he also sold items to other shops across the city.
I have my bag full of stuff. I'd know which shop to go to sell it on, and I'd lay it out on the floor. We'd discuss a price, and I'm out of there with the money.
The British Retail Consortium have told us this is part of a worrying new trend. Unscrupulous shops buying their stock from shoplifters.
Thank you. £10.
The trend that's left shopkeepers like Martin in Truro really frustrated.
We were able to follow a chap straight from a theft, hot on his heels, followed him to the store, actually took pictures of the cash being exchanged, and off they went. Now, that was the first time I was able to actually completely 100% say stolen goods have been taken and sold on.
The government is promising to get tough on shoplifting in an upcoming crime bill, more powers to tackle violent offenders, and a plan to reverse legislation that means low-value thefts under £200 are rarely investigated. But that means more demands on the police. And it also doesn't address the reasons those 70% of people we just mentioned steal, funding their drug habits. Or, as Ross puts it,
people who shoplift are ill, and that's why they're doing it.
Jim Connolly reporting. We're going to be hearing from the boss of Iceland at 10 to 8. 27 minutes past 7 now, and Gary's back with the sport.
Good morning. Joe Root, top of the bill this morning. He scored 143 for England at Lord's, playing Sri Lanka. England will resume on 380 for 7, and here's what Root is hoping for today.
I think we're in a good position, so anything more on what we've done today, I think, is a bonus. And it's not doing all sorts. It's pretty good wicket. It's very slow. I guess we just play what's in front of us. We look to utilise what there is there to tomorrow and see if we can do what we've done well for a period now, taking 20 more wickets.
Root's century was his 33rd for England, and it equals Alistair Cook's record in an hour. I'll speak to former captain Michael Vaughan. Now it's former England coach Paul Farbrace. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Gary.
What impresses you most about his batting?
The fact that he wants to keep getting better, the fact that he keeps pushing himself to improve and not just rest on his laurels and say, look, you know, I'm going to end up as England's leading test scorer, run test scorer. You know, I just keep playing. He doesn't. He looks to improve. He's looking to tinker. He's looking to get better. His mentality is fantastic. And you can just hear from the way that he talks, he keeps the game so simple. He's such a great example to anybody else who wants to play international cricket. The young players in that dressing room should be looking and copying everything that he does.
And he's got 33 test centuries now. He will obviously, you assume, go on to beat the record, and a record that might stand forever.
It could do, but let's hope it isn't. Let's hope that, you know, we've got young players coming through our system that are going to break that. And you know, we don't want Test cricket to wither away and die, but, you know, I think the way that Joe is going, you know, he's going to set a very high standard. He's probably got another 4 or 5 years of Test match cricket in him. And, you know, there's plenty more hundreds to come. So it would be amazing to think what sort of numbers he could reach by both runs and hundreds that he'll score.
Give me a thought on Ollie Pope, a complete contrast. Out for one, he made 12 in the first Test. Is the captaincy affecting the way he is batting? It appears to be.
Look, that's the easy thing to say. I think Popey hasn't quite found that consistency that he needs as an international test cricketer, despite the amount of test matches that he's played. I don't think the captaincy is a big issue. You never know. And you know, Cook, Root himself, they didn't take to captaincy straight away. It takes time to work out your method. It takes time to work out how you prepare and practice and get yourself ready to play test match cricket as a batter whilst being the captain of the team. So far too early to judge him, I think, at this stage.
If you were in the dressing room at Lord's, in a sentence, what would you say to him this morning as he was walking out or in his next innings?
Well, he should just be concentrating on the ball that's coming towards him. That's all you can do. That's why Root scores the amount of runs he scores. That's why Cook scored the amount of runs that he scored. Focus on the ball in front of you. You can't bat for the team. You can't bat for the rest of the players. All you can do is face the next ball, play the challenge of the next ball, and worry about being the captain when you're in the field or you're back in the changing room.
Paul Farbrace, thanks very much. Cheers, Paul. Britain won 6 medals on the opening day of the Paralympics, including 2 gold in the swimming. Poppy Maskell won the 100 butterfly and Tully Kearney the 200 freestyle. Chelsea have qualified for the next stage of the Europa Conference despite losing 2-1 to Servette, but Kilmarnock and Hearts were both eliminated. At the US Tennis Open, Dan Evans and Jack Draper are both through to the third round after straight sets wins, but Katie Bolter has been knocked out. And golf at the British Masters, England's Paul Waring has a 1-stroke lead. Tyrrell Hatton is 2 behind.
Thanks very much, Gary. The modern adaptation of an ancient Indian epic continues.
Welcome to the family business, the real family business.
A dynasty divided by greed, jealousy, and deception.
You want to achieve greatness without getting your hands dirty.
My brother has been a victim of deep fake technology.
You may have forgotten how to fight, but I know exactly what I'm doing.
In search of control and power.
The gods have spoken, and they've done so for a reason.
Mahabharata Now continues on Sunday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Quick look at the weather. Mostly dry for most of us with sunny spells today. A few showers in the south tonight and tomorrow.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, where Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
The US Vice President Kamala Harris has given her first interview since replacing Joe Biden as the Democratic candidate in November's presidential election. She told CNN that Americans were ready to turn the page on divisions, which she blamed on her Republican rival Donald Trump. She said she'd consider appointing a Republican to her cabinet to include people with different views. Mr. Trump dismissed the interview as boring. UNICEF says a planned campaign to administer polio vaccinations to more than 600,000 children in Gaza will be an immense challenge, but it is possible. Israel and Hamas have agreed to a series of three-day pauses in fighting from Sunday to allow the mass vaccination programme to take place. Government plans for flexible working could see people being given the right to request a four-day week and continue to receive full pay by compressing their hours. A Conservative MP has claimed businesses are petrified by the plans, but ministers have insisted the change would not be imposed on companies or individuals. Untreated sewage has been discharged into sites that flow into Windermere in Cumbria continuously for 7 days. The water company, United Utilities, said the overflows were designed to work during heavy rainfall, but campaigners say the system should have been able to cope with the recent weather. Nominations for the next leader of the Ulster Unionist Party will close this afternoon. The only candidate who has declared an interest so far is the party's former leader, Mike Nesbitt. If he's selected, he will be the first person to have twice held the top job in the UUP. The mother of a teenage girl who died after a severe allergic reaction to a hot chocolate bought from a Costa coffee outlet has called on the government to do more to raise awareness of food allergies. A coroner concluded a failure to follow processes contributed to the death of 13-year-old Hannah Jacobs. Costa Coffee said it would consider the comments carefully. Tens of thousands of people, particularly men, are to be offered a midlife health check at work under a new scheme being rolled out by NHS England. The checks are intended to reduce pressure on the health service by catching problems earlier.
Jane, thank you very much. 25 to 8 is the time. For the last 7 days, campaigners and others who live in or enjoy visiting the Lake District have become aware of untreated sewage being released from two water treatment sites close to Lake Windermere. We asked this morning for the company responsible for water in the northwest of England, United Utilities, to do an interview with us about this. They declined, but released a statement saying that the current situation is due to heavy rainfall in the area in August. Here's what our reporter Mairead Smith found when she went there.
Storm overflows at two water treatment plants in Cumbria have been discharging into sites that flow into Windermere. I'm at one of those sites called Near Sorry, which began discharging into Cunsey Beck last Thursday.
So I'm Matt Staniak and I'm the founder of the Save Windermere campaign. And we're here today because Near Sorry Wastewater Treatment Works and Hawkshead Pumping Station have been discharging untreated sewage into a site of special scientific interest for a week straight.
You know this because this is monitored and the evidence is there. What are the issues in your view?
We're aware that it's happening. We know how long it's occurred for, but we don't know how much has actually gone into the environment for us to truly assess the environmental damage that has occurred from this, because dumping sewage, that is going to cause environmental harm.
Cunsey Beck flows here into Lake Windermere, and with it, the discharges from Near Sorry Treatment Works and Hawkshead Treatment Works further north. So is this an issue that visitors here are concerned about?
It's appalling, really, that pollution like that can be pumped out into natural lake and impact on the natural area and the wildlife around.
You can see it floating and... But there's a lot of money being spent and nothing's being done about it.
United Utilities would argue that they are doing a lot about
they
it.
Do. I know. But we don't see it, do we?
It's so beautiful. You know, all the natural wildlife and everything. And you come to this place, it's on our doorstep, and to think of the money that the utilities, United Utilities, what we're paying bills for water, etc., and they're not putting enough money in stopping this. And it's shocking.
That's Mairead Smith reporting from Windermere. We're joined now by Fergal Sharkey, clean water campaigner, previously best known as a singer, and for his career in music. Morning, Fergal.
Good morning.
Can we just go through the detail of the statement that United Utilities have made about this, which is essentially rooted in the extent of rainfall that they say there's been in this area, more than double the amount of average rainfall in the Lake District in recent days. This year, August has seen more rainfall than in any other month, and it is the fourth wettest of the 44 months since January 2021. Now, you obviously campaign on the opposite side to the water companies, but is there something in this about the amount of rainfall that helps explain this situation around Windermere?
Well, I can help United Utilities with this, as indeed the regulator of what has in the last 3 weeks owned up in public. Sewage should only ever be dumped into the environment in exceptional circumstances. That's what the law says. The regulator has admitted it. That's what the law has said for 35 years. Now, the courts have a very particular view of what exceptional circumstances looks like and think of something so rare, so unique, that no reasonable person could think of it, foresee it, and plan against it. We live on an island in the North Atlantic. Heavy rain does not count, and United Utilities and every water company knows that. It's back to blame the Victorians. The simple truth is, what needs to happen here? Ofwat needs to enforce the law, which it knows and admits exists. It admits the extent of it, but has singly failed to intervene and enforce the law with any enthusiasm or drive. And that's why last year, water companies spent 4.6 million hours dumping sewage into the environment. There is nothing exceptional about any of that.
Fourth wettest of the 44 months since January 2021. That's not exceptional then, you'd say?
Not even close to it. Ofwat has written to the companies, including United Utilities, 3 years ago, reminding them of their legal obligation to build, operate, and maintain a sewage system capable of effectively dealing with the contents of those sewers. Doesn't matter what's in there, doesn't matter how it's got there, that's the business they're in.
Understood.
Sitting and alongside everyone, that.
Yeah, and everyone agrees, including the companies, that the system needs that kind of upgrade. It needs investment. Where do you think the money should come from? Because that's one of the debates at the moment, to what extent it should go on customers' bills.
Well, it's actually not a debate, because the second part of that correspondence of what actually admits it has paid the water companies all of the funding they ever needed for 35 years to meet that legal obligation. And water companies for 35 years have certified, confirmed to Ofwat they have the resource and they have the funding. The question we should be asking, they've had our money, what happened to it? And that's why last week I called for a coalition. And in the last 7 days, we've now had 250 different organisations sign up to the March for Clean Water, ranging from the RSPB, the National Trust, the Women's Institute, Surfers Against Sewage, SOS Whitstable, Save Windermere, Mike Stanick. Turn up October the 26th, Whitehall. We need to turn that rage, that frustration, that complete contempt that we are being treated with by the water industry and regulators, turn it into action. Come and join me to protest against the fact we're about to be asked to pay again for a service we've already paid for and we never got.
Does that mean that you don't think that what the new government has done so far and what it's included in the King's speech is sufficient? Because they're saying they're strengthening regulation, cracking down on water companies. Among the things that will be in a new water bill would be personal criminal liability for water bosses, banning the payment of bonuses. Does that not address what you're talking about?
Well, Whitehall has no monopoly in any of this by any means. Welsh Water, for example, is actually the largest sewage dumper in the United Kingdom. Scotland has any number of rivers in bad ecological condition. Loch Ness in Northern Ireland has been poisoned to the extent that it too now turns green, like Windermere. The truth is, all of the laws there, it's existed for 35 years. All of the regulations there, we need it enforced with enthusiasm, drive and ambition, and government plays a part in that. Now, some of the measures being talked about, jailing executives, that's basically been part of Companies Act for 20 years, and I cannot find a single example of any director of any company anywhere in the UK that has even been prosecuted, never mind sent to jail, for a breach of the Companies Act. The truth is, what we really need is a complete and utter root and branch review of the whole sorry mess, this stagnant pool of sewage that we're all standing in. And we need the system that works and functions both for bill payers and the environment. And we need to put an end to this contemptuous display of water companies in the last few days, stamping their foot, demanding bill increases of 40, 50, 60%. And if they don't get it, they're now trying to blackmail society that they'll undermine the attempts to deal with the housing shortage, the attempts to build 1.8 million homes. That's an absolute outrage that any industry would try to extort the nation, society and bill payers. Government needs to take charge. The regulators need to do their jobs.
Fergal Sharkey, thank you very much. We did speak to Water UK, which represents the industry, in the last few days, and they said that investors are not going to stump up the money that is needed unless they receive a sufficient return on their investment.
It's now 18 minutes to eight. The return of a drama you love is one of those things that can make the end of the summer, the return to real life, just a little more bearable. One reason I'm smiling this morning is that Slow Horses, the brilliant TV drama based on the equally brilliant Mick Herron novels, is back. A new series begins on the 4th of September on Apple TV. Now, if you've never watched the TV show or read the books, it's based on a simple idea, a spy thriller in which the heroes are zeros, spies who've been deemed to be failures by MI5 and consigned to doing dull, paper-pushing tests under their abusive, heavy-drinking, chain-smoking, flatulent boss Jackson Lamb, brought to life on the small screen by the brilliant acting of Gary Oldman. He's been speaking to our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Jackson Lamb, you're in charge of the rejects.
I don't like being called that.
What do you call them?
The rejects.
Slow Horses has been a proper word-of-mouth hit, and Gary Oldman has his own way of explaining the show to those who haven't seen it.
The sort of slightly shady, dirty side of espionage. You don't see Money Penny, do you, doing a laundry? We give you it warts and all. It's your PG Tips, Tesco's version of it, I guess.
He plays the hard-drinking Jackson Lamb, who spends a lot more time insulting his MI5 colleagues than he does on his personal hygiene.
Handcuffs won't be necessary, come on.
I'd rather not take any chances with a man who looks like he gropes people on buses.
You're being hurtful about my appearance. I might have to call HR.
How would you describe his smell?
Well, he's a whiskey drinker, so that's obviously coming out of the pores. It's that stale booze and cigarettes and some BO, bit of underarm thrown in.
One of his absolute trademarks is his flatulence. And I believe a lot of debate goes into, number one, how many times he will fart each series. Number two, what they're going to sound like.
Well, these are the conversations. These are the email exchanges that you have with the director. You know, this one is on a leather chair, so it should be more robust. Ridiculous conversations about the frequency.
I'm going back to bed.
Would you also consider a shower?
Yeah, it's a tempting offer, but I don't think that's appropriate right now. I mean, apart from anything else, my team just died.
Slow Horses is often called the anti-Bond. How come you've never been in a Bond film?
I was asked quite a few years ago.
Which one?
I can't remember, but it was a villain. I don't know, it just didn't, the Bond villain didn't ring with me.
On the list of next James Bond is Slow Horses' Jack Loudon. His name gets talked about.
He needs to protect my grandfather.
He's confused all the time. Do you think he's been watched?
You always run off by yourself trying to be a hero.
He's probably a little young at the minute. He could be a young Bond. I'd like to see a sort of prequel with him in the Navy or something, coming up through the ranks.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing ground.
Gary Oldman won a Best Actor Oscar for playing Sir Winston Churchill in Universal's Darkest Hour. But when it comes to recognition, there's one rather surprising omittance.
How come you've never got an honour from the Queen or King?
I don't know. You should ask them.
You've never turned it down?
No. Maybe it's in my future. I don't know. But yeah, no nod from the royals. But there we are.
Now, having a regular role in a long-running TV show is new to you, but not to your family. Because your big sister, Layla Moss, of course, Big Mo, in EastEnders, and she's back in the show once again.
Mo Harris. Don't worry, love. I love a wrong'un.
Is she OK with you treading on her turf of doing the TV?
Yeah, she took a break and is back. I don't see the show, but then Mo, she doesn't really look at my stuff either. I don't think she's running out to see Oppenheimer.
Gary Oldman speaking to Colin Paterson, and that takes us to Thought for the Day this morning with Jasveer Singh from the Faith's Forum for London.
Good morning. This week, Sikhs around the world are marking the anniversary of the compilation of the central Sikh scriptures. By the early 17th century, there were many verses said to have been written by the Sikh gurus, but there was no way of being sure that they were actually their words. The fifth guru, Guru Arjan Devji, set himself a task. He wanted to ensure that Sikhs knew which verses were true and which were fakes, and so he set about bringing them all together into a single volume. His disciples collected all of the verses said to have been written by the four previous gurus, along with compositions from other spiritual people, regardless of their religious backgrounds. The guru went through each of them, studying them carefully and approving those which resonated with Sikh teachings. In late August 1604, the approved verses were compiled into the Adi Granth, or the first book. Once completed, the guru placed the scriptures where he would normally rest, and he rested on the floor below it, showing his reverence for the written word. About a century later, when the 10th Sikh guru was nearing his end, he chose the Sikh scriptures as his successor. The renamed Guru Granth Sahib became the 11th and eternal guru of the faith. They continue to be treated with the greatest of reverence. In Gurdwaras, the Guru Granth Sahib has its own throne for the daytime and a bed where it is put to rest in the evenings. In fact, under Indian law, the scriptures are considered to be a legal person with rights of their own. The printed word is something that many of us find mesmerising. Scrolling through a website is one thing, whilst reading a physical book is a different experience entirely. The feel of the paper, the fixed permanency of the words, even the act of turning over a page, all give a sense of ceremony to reading. Bookshops and libraries are places of hushed silence, of reverence at the centuries of knowledge available to us in the tomes surrounding us. At a time when fake news is rife and AI is enabling misinformation to go further than before, authenticity is something that we place great value upon. It was only a few weeks ago that misinformation led to riots spreading across the country, with a library in Liverpool being torched in the process. It's very easy for us to get lost in our smartphones and doom scroll for hours upon end. Knowledge is invaluable, but having information which has a stamp of approval helps reassure us that what we're looking at is true, not fake. If we want to be sure that what we're reading is real, maybe it's worth putting the phone down and questioning the authenticity of what we're looking at.
That was Thought for the Day with Jasveer Singh. It's now 7:50. And it's time to talk about shoplifting.
Yes. Which?
The story of Ross, the drug addict in Leeds, who told us that if shoplifting was an Olympic sport, he would have got a gold medal, generated a huge reaction. In his interview on the programme yesterday, he revealed that he stole tens of thousands of pounds of goods from one set of shops to order to supply another set of shops who wanted cheaper product to sell and yet had never been sent to prison. Michael Heath is a former judge. He retired after sitting at Lincoln Crown Court for over 20 years and think courts need to do more to send shoplifters to prison.
In appropriate cases, the court should use their power to deprive the defendant of his or her liberty, and they should be quite robust about it. In my opinion, unless there is some compelling counter-argument in a given case, repeat offenders should be sent to prison. The courts have the power to do it, and they should exercise that power. Otherwise, if courts never send anybody away, people can and will conclude that they can shoplift with impunity. In the case of any crime, be it shoplifting or any other crime, if the prosecution never prosecute and or the courts never send anyone to prison for it, the offence is devalued and there becomes a general free-for-all, or call it lawlessness if you will. And that is completely out of place in our society.
The boss of one of the country's big retailers believes his security staff need more powers to combat people like Ross and the gangs that run them. Well, we can talk to the managing director of Iceland now, Richard Walker. Morning to you, Richard.
Morning, Nick.
Before we talk about what you do, how big a problem for Iceland is it?
It's a massive problem, not just for us, of course, but for every retailer. We'll lose over £20 million a year in stock loss, which is essentially theft. And of course, that's money that's being directly taken away from reinvestment, from wage increases, from contributing to lowering prices. So it is a big issue in that sense. It's also an issue, as we all know, in terms of the vitality of our high streets. These are our communities, our senses of place, and I think it's very important that people feel safe there. But most importantly, and the biggest concern, and where it gets upsetting for me, is it's a problem in terms of violence against shop workers. And, you know, we've heard about this before, but it is so upsetting. And I see the serious incidents report every Monday morning, and there are several every week. Serious incidents are where there's been physical assaults on our staff, and that can also include weapons, hammers, knives, needles, you name it. For us, violence against staff has increased from about 600 incidents per year to nearly 1,000 last year, and I think we're tracking roughly on the same trajectory this year.
And indeed, want to give greater powers to your security staff, powers or indeed protection so that they can physically intervene?
Yes, well, I think we just need to look at every tool that's available in our toolbox. You know, I was in Spain really recently, and you look at the security guards there, they don't mess about. They've got pepper spray and handcuffs, whereas there is, of course, a definite limitation to the amount that our in-store security can do. And of course, you know, we're not talking about the desperate person who's struggling to make ends meet here. We're talking about professional shoplifters who absolutely know their rights. So, It's good to see Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, talk about beefing up the laws around shoplifting, making assaults on shop workers a specific criminal offence, putting thousands more police onto our streets. But also, I think we need to look at other stuff. So potentially, yes, more powers to install security teams, like you said.
So they would effectively have some of the powers of the police, some of the powers to intervene.
Yes, potentially, or even, you know, just using existing laws that are out there, existing technology that's out there, but that we're being stymied with because of data protection acts, for example. So we're not allowed to share known images of shoplifters on high street WhatsApp groups because of the human rights of the shoplifters.
So you would like to publicise the images that you take on those cameras on WhatsApp groups, but potentially on posters in shops or in town centres?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, why not? I mean, this, as I've painted a picture, this is very, very serious. So we need to be using all the technology that's available to us. And I'd encourage our store colleagues to do that anyway.
What about the sentencing, Richard? Because we just heard from that former judge, Richard.
Yeah.
Michael Heath, I'm sorry. That there are powers. There's been some debate, hasn't there, about whether this so-called £200 limit, in other words, that you get a lesser sentence if the goods you steal are less than £200. Some debate about that. We had a chief constable on the programme yesterday saying it's a myth. It doesn't work that way.
Yes, and I've spoken to the police as well that says in reality, you know, they will, you know, they will attend. But I think it's a signal, isn't it? So removing that £200 floor that exists where I think it's about whether the culprit will be perpetrated or not, removing that does send a real signal. So I think it definitely does have merit, and anything we can do to beef up these existing laws would be good. I mean, the other thing we need to crack down on as well, just whilst I'm here, is keeping a closer eye on social media sites. So I don't know if you've had a poke around Facebook Marketplace recently, but it's the Wild West, and so much stock is ending up there. It's outrageous.
And would be traceable in your view?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not an expert, but you know, local pubs, we need to crack down there too. We seem to be able to tackle pirate sports broadcasting in pubs. So why can't we stop stolen goods being sold?
Pubs, in other words, people coming in with, I mean, it involves frozen meat, doesn't it? People arrive at a pub and say, who wants a steak?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, Richard Walker, thank you for that. Managing Director of Iceland, who's no doubt got the government's ear, because you may recall that he spoke at the Labour Party manifesto launch.
3 minutes to eight. Simon King has the weather.
Michelle, we've got an area of high pressure moving in today, and that's going to settle the weather down. We haven't seen one of these for quite a while, I don't think, actually. So for most of the UK, it's going to be dry with some sunny spells. But across the southwest, the southeast, and the east of England, we've got one and two mist and fog patches around this morning. Those are going to clear away. There might be some fair weather cloud building up in the sky, but still decent sunny spells and temperatures of 21 to 24 degrees. For Wales, the Midlands, and northern England, much the same, really. Again, a few areas of mist and some hill fog around, but that's going to clear away in the next hour or so. Lots of sunshine expected, and again, a bit of fair weather cloud into the afternoon with highs of 18 to 21. Across Northern Ireland, the mist and fog a bit more extensive here, a bit thicker, but it will again clear away and it's going to be dry with sunny spells, highs of 17 or 18 degrees. And across Scotland, again, some mist and fog around southern Scotland in particular, a few showers affecting the far north of Scotland, which will clear. And then again, we are just looking at sunny spells with highs of 14 to 18 degrees. Now, through tonight, because we've got some clear skies, it will turn quite cool, actually. In northeast England and across Scotland, temperatures down to 6 or 7 degrees. There'll be a few mist and fog patches forming in southern areas as well. How about the weekend? Well, on Saturday, we'll see cloud in southeast England spreading a bit further north and westward into southwest England, the South Midlands, and across East Anglia. We could well see some showers, actually, in southwest England. Maybe the odd rumble of thunder here. It will be sunny elsewhere, little cloud in the sky, highs of 17 to 22. By Sunday, a cloudier day for all of us, with some showers in southern England, which will start to spread their way a bit further northward across the UK. Some of those particularly heavy, and a bit warmer on Sunday, highs of 19 to 26.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. It's Friday, so it's any questions tonight. Ben Wright's in the chair. Who have you got for us tonight, Ben?
Good morning, Nick. We're heading to Wales this evening and to a county of rolling valleys, sandy beaches, market towns and ancient castles. Carmarthenshire is also home to the National Botanic Garden of Wales, our hosts for tonight's programme. And on the panel will be the Labour MP and Paymaster General Nick Thomas Simmons, the leader of the Conservative group in the Senate, Andrew R.T. Davies, and the newly elected Green MP, Ellie Chowns. Also joining us will be Emma Pinchbeck, the Chief Executive of Energy UK. And green energy could certainly be a subject that crops up later, but as ever, the questions are in the hands of our audience. We're on air at 8 o'clock this evening and again at 1:10 tomorrow lunchtime.
Ben, thank you very much. After the first medals for Paralympics GB, we'll talk in the next hour to cyclist Steve Bate.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Nick Robinson. Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Friday the 30th of August. The headlines this morning, Kamala Harris has given her first broadcast interview since joining the race for the White House, promising continuing support for Israel and tougher border controls if she's elected. Aid agencies are preparing to vaccinate hundreds of thousands of children in Gaza against polio, with both Israel and Hamas agreeing pauses in the fighting. Workers could be given the right to ask their employers to work a four-day week under government plans to increase flexible working. And the NHS is to offer health checks at work, aimed especially at middle-aged men. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Kamala Harris has used her first broadcast interview of the US election campaign to set out her vision for what she would achieve if she becomes president, promising to turn the page and offer a new way forward. Speaking to CNN, the Democratic candidate outlined several policies and defended her shift in position on key political issues. She insisted her values had not changed on the topics of illegal immigration and climate change, saying she had kept her word and would continue to do so. With her analysis of the interview, here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
Kamala Harris's apparent reluctance to give an extended broadcast interview meant this event assumed an exaggerated significance and placed her under even greater scrutiny. Initially, she struggled to lay out what she would do on day one of the job, talking very generally about creating an opportunity economy and trying to lower the cost of living. But throughout the interview, she appeared calm and confident and, crucially, didn't score any own goals. Asked about recent policy U-turns, Ms. Harris said her values have not changed, before confirming she no longer supports a ban on fracking for natural gas or decriminalising illegal immigration. Addressing Republican claims that she was soft on border issues, she pointed to her previous experience.
Let's be clear, in this race, I'm the only person who has prosecuted transnational criminal organizations who traffic in guns, drugs, and human beings. I'm the only person in this race who actually served a border state as Attorney General to enforce our laws, and I would enforce our laws as president going forward.
Kamala Harris shrugged off personal attacks from Donald Trump by saying only that he was using the same old playbook, and downplayed the historic nature of a black woman running for president, saying she's in the race because she believes she is the best person to do the job, regardless of race and gender. Donald Trump posted his verdict to his social media site in one word: boring.
UN agencies are preparing to start a mass polio vaccination programme in the Gaza Strip this weekend after agreeing a series of three-day localised pauses in fighting with Israel and Hamas. The aim is to vaccinate more than 600,000 children after the first case of polio in 25 years was found in the war-torn Palestinian territory. Louise Waterridge from the agency UNRWA told us if the programme did not go ahead safely, the repercussions could be disastrous.
We're very hopeful that there will be these pauses. The understanding is that they will be from around 6 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I cannot tell you what military operations will happen around that. This is something we will anxiously wait to see because, of course, any military operations during the time we are trying to roll out a vaccination campaign will affect our ability to deliver these vaccinations to children.
Employees could be given the right to ask to work a four-day week under government plans to encourage flexible working. People would then compress their contracted hours into longer days. But ministers insist they won't impose the change on staff or businesses. Our political correspondent David Cornock reports.
Labour came to power promising to make flexible working the default from day one for all workers, except where it's not reasonably feasible. As first reported by the Daily Telegraph, that could allow staff to work four longer days instead of five. An employee would still have to work their full hours to receive their full pay. Details are expected in the autumn when a law to create a new package of workers' rights is likely to begin its journey through Parliament. A Department for Business and Trade spokesperson insisted the government had no plans to impose a four-day working week on employers or employees. They added that the plan for more flexible working was instead designed to increase productivity and help get more people back into work.
The SNP's autumn conference gets underway later. It's the first time the party has come together since it lost 500,000 votes and 39 seats in the general election, leaving it with just 9 MPs at Westminster. Here's our Scotland correspondent, Lorna Gordon.
The SNP has been an election-winning machine in Scotland for 17 years, but the scale of its losses in the general election means this has the potential to be a downbeat conference for the party of government in Scotland. An internal review into those electoral losses is the first item on the party's conference agenda. The SNP's new leader, John Swinney, will be talking to party members, but will also be hoping to push his message to voters who turned away from the SNP in July. Speaking ahead of conference, Mr. Swinney insisted his party would offer the hope and ambition he said Scotland requires, and also that the SNP would prove it was effective in government. His minority government will next week announce hundreds of millions of pounds of cuts to the Scottish budget to fund public sector pay deals, which are more generous than elsewhere in the UK.
Untreated sewage has been discharged into sites that flow into Windermere in Cumbria continuously for 7 days. The water company, United Utilities, said the overflows were designed to work during heavy rainfall. But the campaigner, Fergal Sharkey, told us the recent weather wasn't exceptional and the system should have been able to cope. Tens of thousands of people, particularly men, are to be offered a midlife health check at work under a new scheme being rolled out by NHS England. The checks are intended to reduce pressure on the health service by catching problems earlier. Here's Adam Porter.
More than 16 million people are eligible for an NHS health check, but current data suggests only around 40% of those invited actually complete one. Men in particular are less likely to attend, but are more likely than women to develop cardiovascular disease at an earlier age. Now the scheme's being taken into workplaces, including those in the building, hospitality and transport sectors. The checks will include weight, blood pressure and cholesterol levels. The government's also announced that a new digital version of the cheque will be ready for testing early next year, allowing them to be carried out at home through the NHS app.
A series of strikes by train drivers on LNER has been called off after meetings between the ASLEF union and the company. Staff have been due to walk out every weekend until November as part of a dispute about working practices. The mother of a 13-year-old girl who died after suffering a severe allergic reaction to a hot chocolate bought in a Costa coffee outlet has called on the government to do more to raise awareness of food allergies. Abby Dwile says no parent should have to lose a child in such circumstances. She's been speaking to our correspondent Tim Muffett.
Hannah Jacobs had a severe dairy allergy. In February last year, she visited a branch of Costa Coffee in Barking in East London with her mum, Abby, who ordered two soya hot chocolates. But after Hannah took a sip, she had a severe anaphylactic reaction and died shortly afterwards. A post-mortem examination found that an ingredient in the hot chocolate caused the allergic response. Hannah's mother has now called on the government to boost allergy awareness.
The government just needs to do better. They need to start taking kids that's got allergen seriously. They should have a sticker on every single drinks. Let people know the symptoms of someone having an allergy reaction. Teach everybody how to use EpiPen.
Costa Coffee said it was in the interest of everyone to understand what happened to Hannah, and it would carefully consider comments made by the coroner in her case. The Food Standards Agency says it's developing best practice guidance in relation to allergen information, which will be published early next year.
Tennis. Carlos Alcaraz has been knocked out of the US Open by the unseeded Dutch player Botik van der Zandschulp. The two-time champion Naomi Osaka is also out. But two British players, Dan Evans and Jack Draper, have both made it through to the next round. Paralympics GB are second in the medals table after the opening day of competition at the Paris Games. They have two golds after success in the pool for Poppy Maskell in the women's S14 100 metre butterfly and Tully Kearney in the S5 200 metres freestyle. Weeks after Sir Keir Starmer moved into number 10, his efforts to redecorate seem to be well underway, including apparently relocating a portrait of one of his predecessors. Downing Street officials said they wouldn't comment on the building's interior, but the move has angered some Conservatives. Alfie Tobert reports.
The painting of Margaret Thatcher was commissioned by Gordon Brown, but more than a decade later, it seems the current Labour Prime Minister isn't a fan. Speaking at a book festival in Glasgow, Sir Keir Starmer's biographer Tom Baldwin recalled a conversation with the Prime Minister in which he agreed that the portrait was a bit unsettling. In comments first reported by The Herald, Mr. Baldwin then said he'd asked Sir Keir if he'd get rid of it and received a nod in response. Mr. Baldwin later clarified that he believed it was now hanging somewhere else in the building. During the election campaign, Sir Keir praised Lady Thatcher as a leader who brought about meaningful change. He now appears to have made his own change to the interior of Number 10.
Alfie Tobert reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It's 8:10. It'll be the biggest expansion of childcare ever seen. Free nursery places for babies and toddlers aged from 9 months to 5 years old. 15 hours this September, 30 hours next. When the promise was made, remember, by the Conservatives when they were in government, Labour frequently pointed to the warnings of nurseries that it would be undeliverable, as they simply didn't have the places and couldn't recruit enough staff. Now Labour in power, they say they will deliver it, and tomorrow's the last chance for parents and carers of babies and toddlers to apply for places in England this autumn term. The demand is said to be huge. All this is a crucial part of what is Labour's offer to working families, though some of its supporters are scratching their head this week and wondering if it's odd to make that sort of promise at the same time as talk of putting up the price of petrol and banning smoking in pub gardens. Well, I'm delighted to say we can talk to a familiar voice on this programme, familiar at least from some years ago. Jackie Smith used to be Home Secretary under Gordon Brown, now Baroness Jackie Smith. She's back in Parliament, back in government as Minister for Skills in the Education Department. Jackie Smith, Baroness Smith, welcome back to the Today programme.
Thank you very much, Nick. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Let's start with that nursery announcement, if we can. We heard again and again from your boss at the Education Department, the Education Secretary, when she was Shadow Education Secretary, there simply weren't the places. What's your assessment now?
Well, first of all, I think an enormous amount of hard work by providers and local authorities and others means that from Monday, as you say, we are confident that most of the people that want that 15 hours free childcare for their children will be able to find a place. And, you know, that's obviously enormously important for children in terms of their life chances and parents in terms of their choices to be able to work. What is a much bigger challenge, I think, is providing from next September the 30 hours of free childcare. Because unfortunately, what we inherited from the last government was a pledge to deliver this, but no real plan to ensure that it would happen.
But it is your policy. You could have reversed it. It's now your pledge. And you need, what, 85,000 new places, 40,000 new staff. How are you going to get them?
Which is why, instead of just sort of leaving this to the market to determine, we're working very hard building new relationships with providers and with local authorities. So, for example, we've boosted the recruitment campaign, Do Something Big, to get people into childcare work. We've developed and are encouraging people to take up early years apprenticeships or the new vocational qualifications. It's why we'll be making more announcements about our plans to develop 3,000 nurseries in empty school places in primary schools.
Are you going to give us a timetable on that? Because there was a promise, wasn't there, that because there are fewer children in primary schools over the next few years, you could use some of those disused classrooms to open some nurseries, but you never put a timetable on how and when you do it.
And that's why we'll say more about that in the weeks to come, Nick, because unlike the last government, we're not going to just announce things when we haven't got a plan to actually ensure that we can deliver them. We do think we can make a big amount of progress towards that 30 hours of free childcare next September.
But you can't guarantee it. Just to be clear, you'll make progress, but you may not reach it.
Well, we will do our absolute best to reach it, but it may be that people won't get the place in their first choice or, it may be it takes a bit longer, but we absolutely will work hard to deliver it because, as you suggested, enabling and Bridget Phillipson is absolutely clear that we need a sort of transformation of our education system with a real focus on what happens right at the beginning of children's time in care and in education. That's why, we're also looking at how we make sure that these are high quality places, that they're places that can identify children with special educational needs earlier rather than later. It can be a really big transformation, but it needs not just announcements, it needs a lot of hard work as well, and we're determined to do that, and we started it already.
Well, that is clear. Now, another thing that is clear is that a newspaper story, it was in the Sun yesterday, that ministers were thinking of banning smoking in pub gardens, is a fact. Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, confirmed that he was thinking about doing just that yesterday. Can you explain to people how it makes sense to tell people that they can smoke at home, but they can't smoke outside when they pose less risk to themselves and less risk to their families?
Well, look, Nick, the last time I was in government, you've pointed out that I've been around the block a few times. The last time we were in government, of course, we brought in at that point the smoking ban inside in pubs and restaurants and public places. That has made a phenomenal difference to the amount of smoking related disease that people have and that the health system has to deal with. But there are still 80,000 people dying each year from smoking. So we want to get to a position where actually we see less smoking, we experience less smoking, fewer people are dying from smoking. And we will look at a whole range of things in order to enable us to do that, including, as the Prime Minister said yesterday, thinking about the impact on smokers themselves and on others around them of allowing people to smoke outside.
You're not claiming that smoking outside is passive smoking, though, are you? Because that was the main argument made for banning smoking indoors, wasn't it? That other people suffer directly from the impact of smoke. Pretty hard to make that argument about smoking in a garden, isn't it?
Well, passive smoking, you're right, is a bigger problem inside. But where we now are is saying, look, we want to move essentially to a society in which there is no smoking. That's the reason for building on the last government's plans to increase the age at which you're not able to buy cigarettes. And that means, of course, that we need to find a whole range of ways, both statutory, but also in terms of encouragement, in terms of providing alternatives for people to help to give up smoking, that sort of, if you like, forces smoking out of our communities.
Now, and you will remember that when you were in government, an outspoken colleague of yours, indeed he's a former Home Secretary as well, John Reid, who said, this is an obsession of the learned middle class, he said. What enjoyment does a 21-year-old single mother of three living in a council sink estate get? The only enjoyment sometimes they have is to have a cigarette. Was he wrong then? Is he wrong now? Do you think people who say that this new Labour government doesn't understand working class people are getting it wrong?
I disagreed with John at that point, and I would disagree with him if he were saying it again today. And of course, after him saying that, we introduced the smoking ban, which, you know, I've done some work in the NHS, Nick, in the time in which I've been out of...
Yeah, you chaired a hospital trust, didn't you? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that doctors often said to me was the smoking ban was one of the most consequential public health measures that has been introduced.
But now we're clear about that. And forgive me for interrupting. Seems to me you've been very clear. The principle is to try and stop smoking altogether over time. Why not ban it on the streets then, as they do in Japan?
Because I think there is a balance between enabling choice but also putting in place both the support and the changes in our sort of public spaces that will wean people off smoking and that will push smoking away from where most of us experience it. And just to come back to where I started, you know, whilst we have 80,000 people a year dying from smoking related diseases, I think if there was any other thing where...
Well, it is. There is another thing. There is. There are plenty of other things. There's obesity, Jackie Smith, and you know it well. So if that is the principle, will you ban crisps? Are you going to ban chocolate? Are you going to ban alcohol? Are you going to ban all the other things that kill us?
We are thinking about how we can make changes in advertising rules and other things on those. Smoking is one of the things, probably the main thing, for which there is absolutely no health benefit and almost a certainty that your health will suffer and you may well die. That's why, to be fair to the last government, or the last prime minister at least, it was a priority for them as well. They were right. But we have built on their plans in order to make sure that we will be seeing fewer of those 80,000 people each year dying from smoking related diseases. That's not just good for them as individuals. That's good for our health service, which we know is under enormous pressure from smoking related diseases.
Jackie Smith, Baroness Smith, thank you for joining us back here on the Today Programme. We'll talk again soon.
20 past eight. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have barely 2.5 months left before America votes. And for her, this incredibly short period in the spotlight as the Democratic Party's choice has so far seemed to be working. Last night was her first TV interview as a presidential nominee on CNN with her chosen Vice President Tim Walz by her side. She was asked how her policy positions on issues such as fracking and the southern border have shifted.
The most important and most significant aspect of my policy perspective and decisions is my values have not changed. My value around what we need to do to secure our border, that value has not changed. I spent 2 terms as the Attorney General of California prosecuting transnational criminal organizations, violations of American laws regarding the passage, illegal passage of guns, drugs and human beings across our border. My values have not changed.
Well, I've been speaking to Amanda Renteria, who was Hillary Clinton's national political director when she ran against Donald Trump. How did she think Kamala Harris performed?
She met the expectations, or I'd even say exceeded the expectations. People were really going to be watching tonight. Did she answer questions? Was she forthright? Did she know, her policies and her vision and her values? And what you saw tonight was someone who was thoughtful, who was clear about where she was, and who explained how she has evolved over time as well.
Well, on evolving over time, though, she denied, didn't she, that she's changed her mind on key issues, and yet she has. She used to want to ban fracking. Now she votes in favour. She used to be more liberal on crossings across the Mexican border. Now she'd continue funding the wall.
Well, I think there's a difference between the image that she has had. So I'm in the state of California. She was the attorney general here. She was very strong on making sure to prosecute trafficking, known to do that here as attorney general. And so some of what this interview was about was really telling people what she has actually done in her record, as well as saying when I was in California or when I was the California senator, how she might have looked at issues a little bit differently than when she was the vice president of the entire country. And I think actually that's an important part of the conversation when you're running for president, is how are you going to govern, not just for the state of California, but really the entire country. And in that sense, I think it was important for her to explain how she has evolved on some of these issues, where perhaps when she was in California, she saw it one way. And now that she's running for president and she's been vice president now over a couple of years, how that has changed. And I think people who are watching really do understand when you are in different roles, the kind of way you govern, the kind of way you think about policies. And it really does broaden your perspective.
Why didn't she do the interview on her own?
I think this has been an interesting thing. So you only have so much time in an election cycle. And what she and Waltz have done is really introduce themselves as really the full picture of what her administration would be, of what the Democratic Party would be. When you have a lot of time, like Trump does or normal campaigns, you get a chance to not only introduce yourself, but then once you name your vice president, you get a chance to also introduce your vice president. In this case, they've got to do it both very, very quickly with only, you know, 80 something days when they first started.
But isn't
that, it does make sense to do it together.
Really, isn't it precisely an argument for in little time, you're presenting yourself to the American people as the woman who wants to be the next president. Set that tone. I will be your president. I don't need to have someone sitting beside me.
Yeah, I think anyone that looks at her recognizes that she's in charge. Anyone that watched her DNC speech knows that she's in charge. But what she is doing is her whole entire message is about unity. And so it does present differently when it is just her versus both of them as a ticket. And generally at this point in a campaign, you need to really be showing the country what your administration is going to look like, not just what you as president is going to be. And I think it actually does help to have the full ticket on display so people get a chance to meet both of them and what her administration would look like.
It will be just her when she debates Donald Trump in that TV debate. You will remember, I'm sure, very well when you worked for Hillary Clinton and what that debate was like for her against Donald Trump. What would you advise Kamala Harris?
I think what she did tonight when she answered the question about what do you think about what Trump said attacking you or attacking your race? And her answer was, these are old plays. To the extent that she can really get her message out there and not get distracted by the personal attacks. And really, when people are watching these debates, I think more and more what you're seeing is people are tired of seeing the personal attacks. What they want to hear is how are you going to affect their lives at home? How are you going to help them? And have a little fun up there. I think at the end of the day, people have enjoyed the joy that her and Waltz have brought to this campaign cycle. I hope she does not lose that.
What do you make then of the decision or the push from her campaign team to change the rules since the last debate, to keep everyone's mics live? So essentially, she would be able to speak over Donald Trump and he would be able to speak over her.
You know, what the campaign has seen on the Harris-Waltz side is you have a candidate that really is not disciplined. So the truth is they're opening up the microphone and saying, go ahead, show the country who you are. I think it's a gamemanship kind of thing. But what people are going to watch is how do they comport themselves and can actually Trump be disciplined and make sure he gives room for people to speak in like fashion.
What are her vulnerabilities, would you say?
You know, I think Trump has a knack for even though you are ready for the unusual and even though you are ready for the attacks, he always seems to find a way to rustle, you know, people's feathers, to get them, ruffle them up. And so I do want to give him credit for the ability to do something that you don't expect. And so it is going to be important for her to just stay on message and be ready for that.
And that's the danger zone. That's the danger zone, isn't it? He came up with Crooked Hillary. He stuck with it.
Right.
He needled her. Perhaps he's just getting started. You know, I mean, this has clearly taken him by surprise, the events of the last month. That form of attack is almost certainly coming.
Sure. And I think the difference is that folks have seen this before, not just candidates and campaigns, but the public. And it's not quite as interesting, but there's always still something you need to be ready for with a candidate who is willing to say anything in a debate. And he will certainly figure out what is a thing that could kind of get you. And so I think that's what she has to be careful about. Good news is she's been in a lot of courtrooms, been a prosecutor, been in the public eye during this period of intensity while he was president. She's had a lot of training ground for this.
Do you think that she is a better candidate than Hillary Clinton, or do you think she's just been luckier?
I think she is right for the moment that we are in. When people talk about the prosecutor versus the felon, that captures a moment in time that we are in. And so for this moment, I think you have the exact right candidate. Kamala is exactly at the moment where we need her.
Amanda Renteria, thank you.
Thank you.
27 minutes past eight. It's all getting quite exciting in the cricket, Gary, isn't it?
Very much so. And cricket history, very close for Joe Root. He hit 143 for England at Lord's. It was his 33rd century for England. It equals Alistair Cook's record. England resumed this morning on 358 for 7 against Sri Lanka. It was also Root's 6th century at Lord's, which equals a record held by Graham Gooch and also Michael Vaughan. Michael Vaughan, good morning.
Good morning.
What impresses you most about Root?
He's, in my opinion, England's greatest batter across all the formats. He just makes batting look so easy. You know, we're in an era where I guess the white ball is dominant with the franchise leagues and players whack it out of the park on a regular basis. But give me a Joe Root any day of the week. I just hope all kids and, you know, younger boys and girls that are setting out to play the game are looking at the way that Joe Root plays and they're trying to emulate his style of play rather than the crash band wallet players.
Yeah. How long can he continue at this level? He's 33.
Well, I think he's still got a few years. His main kind of strength, obviously he's a great player and he can play all the different skill sets, but it's his enthusiasm for the game. He's just obsessed with playing the game and batting. Sachin Tendulkar is at the top of the all-time list on over 15,000, and Joe Root's 3,500 away from that. And I reckon if he can keep that back right, that target is certainly on the cards.
Tell me your thoughts on the new captain, Ollie Pope, out for one yesterday, out for 12 at Old Trafford. He was our guest at this time yesterday. Your analysis of what's happening to him?
Well, I just think, you know, Ollie Pope, the batter, is a very talented player, but he's got a real problem at the start of an innings. I mean, he gets out 40% of the time inside 20 balls and, you know, that's a real problem. He just seems to be a little bit frantic. I don't see him as a captain. I just think he's a wonderful young player that once you give him the captaincy, I just think there's too much of a burden on him. I'd have preferred it to go to someone else. But, you know,
who would you have preferred it to go to?
I'm a big Harry Brook fan. I think Harry Brook's a ready-made England captain in the future. It's an interim. You remember that Ben Stokes will be back in a few weeks' time. And, you know, Ollie Pope's been doing really well at number three in the Ben and the Baz McCullum era. And since he's got the captaincy, and that can happen when you get the captaincy. Obviously, there's more to think about and you get a few low scores.
How did it affect you, Michael?
I struggled at the start because there's so many other things to think about as a captain. But when you're interim, you don't have to do too much. You're basically just taking the team out onto the pitch. It's just that start of an innings for Ollie Pope. That's when he's struggling inside the first 20 balls. He's just got to be a little bit calmer. Go and sit next to Joe Root. That'd be my advice. And try and ask Joe Root how he copes with it.
Michael Vaughan, thanks very much. Cheers, Michael.
Thank you.
British swimmers Poppy Maskell and Tully Kearney won gold medals on the opening day of the Paralympics. Britain won 6 medals in total. Jack Draper and Dan Evans are through to the third round of the US Tennis Open. Katie Bolter has been knocked out in golf at the British Masters. England's Paul Waring is top of the leaderboard, 1 stroke clear of the field. There will be more on the Paralympics in 15 minutes.
Yes, we will be speaking to Steve Bate and Chris Latham, who have together won one of Paralympics GB's silver medals. And now, what is we have the reunion coming up at 9. Kirsty Walker is looking back to 2012.
Over 12 exhilarating days, the London Paralympics captivated the nation. In the reunion, we have a gold medal winning lineup. Swimmer turned cyclist Sarah Storey won 4 gold medals. Wheelchair racer Hannah Cockcroft stole hearts and broke records, winning 2 on the track. Rower Naomi Richards got the gold that had eluded her in Beijing. And Swimmer Ollie Hind had to beat his brother to win his gold. And not forgetting former wheelchair basketball star Adia Depitan, part of the Channel 4 television team. With the Paris Games as our backdrop, that's the 2012 Paralympians on The Reunion. In half an hour and on BBC Sounds.
We look forward to that, Kirsty. Thank you. Quick look at the weather. Mostly dry with sunny spells today. A few showers in the south tonight and tomorrow.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, where Jane Steele has a summary of the news. The US Vice President Kamala Harris has given her first broadcast interview since replacing Joe Biden as the Democratic candidate in November's presidential election. She told CNN she would be tough on immigration, would continue to support Israel, and could appoint a Republican to her cabinet. Her Republican rival, Donald Trump, dismissed the interview as boring. Aid agencies are preparing to roll out a mass polio vaccination programme to hundreds of thousands of children in Gaza. Both Israel and Hamas have agreed to a series of three-day pauses in fighting. The Education Minister, Baroness Jackie Smith, has told us the government will face challenges meeting its pledge of 30 hours of free childcare by next September. She told us ministers were committed to providing more flexibility for working parents, but said some may not be able to get a place at the nursery of their choice. Government plans for flexible working could see people being given the right to request a four-day week and continue to receive full pay by compressing their hours. A Conservative MP has claimed businesses are petrified by the plans, but ministers have insisted the change would not be imposed on companies or individuals. Jane, thank you very much. Drug availability in prisons is so widespread now that it is barely newsworthy. But a man has just been sentenced for producing and supplying Class A and Class B drugs, offences that took place while he was a serving prisoner himself at HMP Swaleside in Kent. The 33-year-old was part of a large gang that included his mother. We're joined by Nick Hardwick, former Chief Inspector of Prisons and former Chair of the Parole Board, and by Tom Wheatley, who is President of the Prison Governors Association. Welcome to you both.
Good morning. Good morning.
I'm wondering if the details of this even surprise you, even in the context of what you've seen. At one point, this man, Alexander Mullings, was organising the manufacture of synthetic opioids, including obtaining the necessary apparatus, a recipe, sourcing chemicals from China, and discussing with his associates how to significantly upscale production. Tom?
That is, it's serious organised crime, Michelle. That there is no two ways about it. One shouldn't expect people who have lived that lifestyle, who have been serious organised criminals, to simply stop because they've been imprisoned. And unfortunately, technology has moved on significantly. So availability of mobile phones, availability of drones as a form of conveyance, mean that prison staff, prison governors and their teams are fighting an uphill battle to try and prevent this from happening. I think this story is in many ways very good news because an investigation, which was obviously very complex and long, has resulted in a conviction and significant sentences for those involved.
But this is a man who is under the control of the state. He's had his liberty taken away and he was able to control and arrange the movement of drugs across the country. This gang could have produced a yield estimated with a wholesale value of more than £1.5 million. The instinct of people, the desire to continue the same behaviour must be there. But isn't it a complete failure of the prison system that someone inside can carry on to this extent?
It is a failure in as much as prisons are unable currently to prevent illicit communication. So if prisoners manage to get mobile phones into prison, which they can get in through a variety of ways, including using drones to deliver them over the wall, once they've got access to mobile telephony, we are struggling then to prevent them from using that to contact associates outside prison and to organise and plan criminal enterprise. There's an awful lot of work goes into catching, to finding mobile phones, to catching those that are using them and to trying to get convictions through the court. But without technology in prisons keeping pace with the technology that allows that communication, that is increasingly difficult.
Nick Hardwick, is that the key to this? You stop the mobile phones and you bring a stop to the possibility of this kind of enterprise?
I think that's part of it. I mean, this is, I mean, I agree with Tom. We shouldn't be surprised that, you know, organised crime bosses continue to organise crime once they're in prison. A key issue here, I think, is that, I mean, fairly recently, Swaleside, that holds some of the most serious offenders, I think in the last year, seven staff have been dismissed for corruption. And in the most recent inspection report, the chief inspector found that staff lacked confidence and assertiveness. And I think the real risk now, I mean, we talk about prison capacity in terms of the physical space available, but a more important issue is whether we've got sufficient experienced staff to manage prisoners like the men who were the serious organized criminals who are carrying out this kind of activity. It's not just about technology. It's about whether you've got staff who've got the confidence to intervene when they see something that causes them concern, with the experience to know that something on the wing isn't quite right and then to do something about it. And without that experience and the numbers, then you leave the space open for men like this to do the harm they're doing. And the other one, just to very quickly say, one of the consequences of these men's activity would have been a surge of violence in these prisons, because the supply of drugs requires violence to enforce the debts that then follow. These will have been major disruptors for the prison system as a whole.
So it has a knock-on effect and in other ways. Tom Wheatley, it's interesting the way that Nick Hardwick puts it about confidence and assertiveness. Would you say that, I mean, he's talked about experience. I'm wondering if also it's also, I'm sure, linked to the numbers of staff. You have a confidence from being, you know, of a certain strength on the prisoner officer side. But is it also about inherent personality traits, that there might be people who will be too intimidated and therefore might choose to look away when they see something suspicious?
That is possible. That is possible. It's during the period of time where this activity was taking place, Swaleside was significantly understaffed. That position is somewhat better now, but it was certainly a factor at the time. And having sufficient, well-trained and well-motivated staff is essential to running effective prisons. During this period of time, the governor and his team would have been struggling to do that, because they simply didn't have enough people. The prison service made a number of changes and refocused some activity on recruitment. But what that means is, having recruited those people needed to fill the vacancies that they have, they've recruited a lot of people all at once. So that means you would then end up with a very inexperienced staff group. So just having the right number of people there doesn't necessarily solve the problem. This is about having confident people, as Nick points out, who are able to challenge, who feel that they are equipped to deal with some of the really difficult and often violent men who we have in our prisons.
But do we have, Nick Hardwick, you think, the right level of staffing at the moment, so that at least in time the experience is there?
I think we are. It is improving. But, I mean, the government's got plans to very quickly increase the number of prisons and the number of prison places. All of those will need to be staffed, which means that overall you'll have a higher proportion of your staff who will be new, managing these new large prisons, without, in a sense, the ballast of the experienced old hands who know what they're doing, who have the confidence to act, who can make the relationships with prisoners that keep prisons safe. So I am concerned. I think this case is a wake-up call and ought to cause government to think really seriously about how they make sure that prisons, as they grow, have the right staff. And that's a very tough ask.
Nick Hardwick, Tom Wheatley, thank you.
It is a 20 to 9 now. On its front page this morning, the Daily Mail attacks what it calls a gesture of astonishingly petty vindictiveness against a political giant by a PM of just 7 weeks. It's referring to the revelation that comes from Sir Keir Starmer's biographer Tom Baldwin that the portrait of Margaret Thatcher that hung in what is now known as the Thatcher Room, but used to be called the Number 10 Study, has been removed from this room because after the two men had a meeting and Mr. Baldwin commented that it was a bit unsettling with her staring down at you like that, isn't it? Sir Keir answered yes, and then had the painting removed. Well, let's talk to the painter of the portrait, Richard Stone. Good morning to you.
Well, good morning to you.
Do you think it's unsettling?
Well, it's not the first word that springs to mind when I recall that portrait, but I see it as something of a compliment in a way, because my sense of judging a good portrait, when looking at a painted portrait, if you sense you're in the presence of that person, then it, you know, it starts ticking boxes for me. And if in this circumstance, two people looking at this portrait found it unsettling, well, then I'd like to think that my portrait of Margaret Thatcher, you know, had a presence in that room.
You think it captured it, but do you think it belonged in what was renamed the Thatcher Room?
Well, the original commission coming from the then Prime Minister Gordon Brown was for a portrait to hang permanently in Downing Street, which is not the same as actually having a sort of designated spot for it. And when the portrait was unveiled, it was actually, I think at the time, hanging in a vestibule. And it was only when Davy Cameron became Prime Minister that it was moved to what was then her old office, which, of course, seemed an entirely appropriate place. But, of course, I'm only the artist, and I just paint portraits, so I don't actually have any say as to where they should hang.
You don't, but I'm giving you a say. Do you find it unsettling that, to coin a phrase, that the portrait has been removed from the room that she loved and the room that was named after her?
No, it is not a word that I would use. I'm very philosophical. Where my portraits hang is entirely up to the, if you want, the owner, the custodian of the picture.
So Sir Keir can have whoever he wants in that room.
Well, if it remains in number 10, then I'm very happy.
It's an interesting point you make about the fact that the portrait captured the woman. So if you were one of those who found her unsettling, maybe you found the portrait unsettling. Did she? Or did she think it captured her?
Oh, well, most definitely. And in fact, one of the most memorable comments I have ever received from any sitter was from Lady Thatcher when she saw the finished picture. She lightly touched the pearls at her throat and was thinking of something appropriate to say. And with a little break in her voice, she said, "It is how one would wish to be remembered."
It's even the use of the word "one" there just
yes.
instantly brings back memories of Margaret Thatcher, as does indeed that painting. Richard Stone, thank you very much indeed for joining us. It reminds me, she's no great fan of the BBC's, as you all know, Margaret Thatcher, but when I was political editor of ITV, I was invited to have a whisky with the great lady, and she looked rather like she does in that portrait.
What was the conversation like?
Memorable.
One
she recalled
the
story of telling George Bush not to go wobbly.
Oh, very good. Okay, John Humphreys used to talk about the time when she called in to this programme and pretty much demanded to go on air.
That's right. She just heard that Gorbachev was not able to come on a visit to Britain because there'd been an earthquake, I think, in Russia. And she called in the office and somebody thought it was a joke. Someone impersonated her. It wasn't about her.
Our editors just confirmed that other presenters, other prime ministers, can do the same if they feel particularly exercised on any given morning. Let's turn now at 9:15 to an interview that has been given to the BBC by the mother of a 13-year-old girl who died after suffering a severe allergic reaction in a coffee shop. She is calling on the government to do more to raise awareness of food allergies. Abby Dwile has been speaking about the moments after her daughter Hannah Jacobs realised that the soya milk hot chocolate she'd ordered was actually made of cow's milk.
After one sip, that was it. She called me from the toilet and said, "That was not soya hot chocolate." She was shouting, she was screaming. It happened so quickly at that point. If I'm asking for something and I'm asking what's in that, all your staff should know what ingredient goes in everything. Every single person, restaurant, coffee shops, need to know.
Abby Dwilo was speaking to Tim Muffett, our correspondent. Tim, what else did she say about these terrible moments before Hannah died?
Yeah. Yes, it's such an awful story. Hannah, her daughter, had a severe dairy allergy and she was 13 when in February last year she and her mum went into a Costa Coffee in Barking in East London. Now, Abby says because of Hannah's dairy allergy, she ordered two soya hot chocolates and she says she also asked the person serving her to clean the equipment before doing so. But shortly after Hannah took a sip, that's when things went tragically wrong and she tragically died soon afterwards. Now, a post-mortem examination found that Hannah died after suffering from a hypersensitive anaphylactic reaction triggered by an ingredient in her hot chocolate that caused an allergic response. And the coroner's report earlier this month also found that there had been a failure of communication between the coffee shop staff and Hannah's mother, and a failure to follow processes. Now, Abby was telling me that she believes there's simply not enough awareness about food allergies. She says, and she believes, that many parents are dismissed as being too fussy or that their children are fussy eaters. And she says the government simply needs to do more, to take the issue more seriously. She wants labels specifying allergens to be made compulsory in cafes and restaurants. She wants widespread training on the use of EpiPens to be introduced. Now, these can help during an allergic reaction. She basically wants no other family to go through what she's been gone through.
And the coffee shop where it happened, it was a branch of Costa Coffee, wasn't it? What have they said?
Yes, well, they've said that in a statement that the loss of Hannah is a tragedy, that their heartfelt thoughts remain with her family and friends, and that it does have strict allergy training and procedures in place to minimise the risk to those customers who suffer from allergies. However, they agree with the coroner's conclusion that the allergen process was not followed that day at its franchise partner store, which is where this terrible incident took place. And it continues to review what more it can do to when training team members to help minimise the risk to customers who have allergies. So a desperately sad story. Hannah's mum, keen to get across how seriously she believes food allergies need to be taken. And she, as I said before, simply doesn't want anyone else to go through what her family has gone through.
Tim Muffett, thank you.
It is 12 minutes to 9. If Oasis can do it, why not the Smiths? If the Gallagher brothers can bury their differences and get the band back on the road, why not Morrissey and Johnny Marr? Well, we know the answer to that because the Smiths' notoriously irascible lead singer Morrissey revealed yesterday he'd agreed to do a tour in 2025, like Oasis, but claimed that Johnny Marr had ignored an offer he described as lucrative. Well, who's got it right? A man who knows. Has his own band, which is back on tour. Tom Robinson. Band, of course, and Tom is in the studio with us now. Best known, perhaps, for being a presenter on Six Music. Morning to you, Tom.
Hello, Nick.
Have they made the right call, either the Gallaghers or indeed Morrissey and Johnny Marr?
Well, Johnny Marr actually went on Twitter to give his reasons, and very succinct. A fan tweeted exactly what you just said: if the Smiths can do it, if Oasis can do it, why can't the Smiths? And he just tweeted a picture of Nigel Farage. And that
a reference to the fact that Morrissey is thought to have drifted somewhat to the right.
I think so, yeah. Since the days when they appeared at the Red Wedge Tour, I remember, back in the 80s.
Yeah, which was in favour of Neil Kinnock when he was leader of the Labour Party.
Exactly so, yeah, their last ever gig was at Red Wedge in Newcastle, and I was there. It was amazing.
And since then, he's been caricatured, Morrissey, hasn't he? On The Simpsons a right-wing character.
But, you know, both of those bands, the music is absolutely of its time. It reflects the times that it's made in, and so very, very few bits of music really do sum up the times they're living in.
And so, to that extent, when you heard the news about Oasis, did your heart soar rather than sink? Because sometimes
And forgive me, I can say this as I'm a man of a certain age. Old boys getting back together does sometimes make people think, honestly, just let us remember the good times.
Well, the thing is, that demand has been out there the whole time. There are so many Oasis tribute bands out there playing in the pubs and clubs around the country. There's no Oasis. There's definitely Oasis. You know, I mean, dozens, literally dozens of tribute bands. So the demand for that music has never gone away. So obviously, they are the ultimate tribute band, the two of them getting back together.
And what about your decision to put the Tom Robinson Band on the road? Now, people of a certain age will remember 2468 Motorway. They'll remember Glad to Be Gay. Big decision to get back, or do you just love playing music and you'll play if people want to come and listen?
Well, the thing is, my 15 minutes of fame, such as it was, happened in times of economic uncertainty and far-right violence, you know. So we were involved in Rock Against Racism at the time, doing our best to kind of reflect again the times we were living in, and those are times that we find ourselves in again. I don't have the option of reforming that band because, alas, Danny Custo, the original guitarist, is no longer with us, but I do have a great band that I've had for the last 20 years, and we've gone back to the first two albums to go out and do a 20-date tour.
So you're on tour this autumn. Will music ever have the political power, the social power? Because what you said about gay rights had real power then, what you were saying about society. Will it ever go back to that, or is it, as I think Noel Gallagher said the other day, didn't he? It's just about shifting records and making profit.
Well, the thing is, back in the 70s, 80s and 90s, music played a different part in our culture. We have social media now, which fulfills the same messaging function for youth culture to kind of transmit itself. So the music is now product. It's not even product. I mean, it's content rather than product.
That's
these days.
Fascinating, Tom. You're saying in a way that the anger we saw, the passion, all emerged on stage and through carrying that single that you'd bought in the shop, not needed anymore in that way.
It was identity. Well, the music you bought and the concerts you went to and the clothes you wore reflected who you felt you were in a way that it doesn't today. Wearing a Taylor Swift T-shirt doesn't tell you something about yourself in quite the same...
You post online instead, which is a bit of a shame, really, isn't it? Tom Robinson, thanks very much. Good luck with the tour. Tom Robinson Band, go online. They've got a website. And Six Music, of course.
Thanks, Nick.
7 minutes to nine. British medals of the Paris Paralympics so far include two golds in the pool for Poppy Maskell and Tully Carney, and three silvers in the velodrome for Daphne Schrager and for Steve Bate and his sighted pilot Chris Latham, who won that medal in the men's B4000-metre individual pursuit final. And they are both on the line from Paris now. Good morning. Congratulations.
Cheers, thanks very much.
Hey, guys.
Steve, this sounds like an incredible race because you together broke a world record in the process of getting to that silver medal.
Yeah, I think there might be a world record for the shortest time holding a world record, I think, because it got broken about 3 minutes later. So, it was amazing, absolutely amazing.
And how long have you two been a pair, you and Chris?
About 3 years now, I think.
So this is your first Paralympics together. Chris, what was it like for you?
Yeah, no, it's great. It's a whole different experience, the para side of things, and I've been really enjoying it so far.
What does it take to get that relationship working as well as it needs to end up on the podium?
I think the main thing is you've just got to get on. You know, if you get on off the bike, on the bike kind of takes care of itself, if you will. We've both got, you know, a similar sense of humour and whatnot. So we get on like house on fire.
And how much time did you have training together, Steve, before Paris?
I think I've probably spent more hotel rooms and trips away with Chris than I have my wife this year. So, yeah, we've spent a fair bit of time together over the last 9 months.
We're not like that, though.
But, it's been an incredible kind of nine-month build-up for us. And, he's a great guy to have in front of me for sure.
And before that, Steve, an incredible few years for you. I think it was in 2011 that you were told that you will lose your sight one day. And am I right, if I've added this up correctly, between Rio, Tokyo and now Paris, you've got two golds, two silvers and a bronze?
Yeah, that is correct, yeah. Unbelievable, eh?
Well, it really is. What do you think sport gave to you in that period after you had that very difficult news?
I probably the opportunity. I think when I found out I could race on the back of a tandem and potentially get to a Paralympic Games, you know, that was a massive opportunity. And you know, I spent a lot of time climbing rocks before then, and yeah, I think it was just the chance to maybe become a Paralympian. You know, just to go to a Games, not even medal, was probably a real driver for me. To see if I was, you know, if I'd ever be good enough. You know, I was 36 then, and most people had finished their careers and retired at that age, and I was just beginning mine.
And you weren't a competitive cyclist before that? Were you even a keen cyclist before that?
Yeah, I mean, I rode a mountain bike and messed around with my mates, but yeah, I'd never raced a bike at all.
And then this whole new phase of your life began. Chris, what is it like for you? Because obviously you were, and I imagine you, are you still a competitive cyclist outside this, outside working with Steve?
Not anymore. You have to do the tandem and para side of things. I think you have to be out of AB, able body competition for about a year or so. So I've just kind of put it all to one side and just, you know, fully committed to the tandem and para side of things.
What has it given to you?
Got a silver medal last night.
Yeah. Fair enough. I mean, working with Steve, seeing what he's done with his life and the challenges that he confronts.
Yeah, no, it's been good. It's been it's a big eye-opener, you know, coming to the para side of things and seeing how people just, you know, crack on with you know, various disabilities, and it's all been a big learning experience for me. It's been it's quite, you know, it's eye-opening and enjoyable at the same time.
Steve, Chris, this all takes me back to when I went to the Paralympics in 2012, and I'm going to be honest with you, I went because I couldn't get tickets for the main games, and found the events not only exciting in themselves as sporting events, but incredibly uplifting. Have you noticed just the change that's happened? It's almost not noteworthy that these are, as it were, games for people with disabilities.
Yeah, I actually didn't go to 2012 at all. I wasn't really that bothered by it, to be honest, which sounds terrible to say now sitting here talking to you. But yeah, I think it's been an amazing thing. Like, you know, a lot of people ask us about, you know, should the Olympics and Paralympics be joined together like the Commonwealth Games are per se? And I think it's really important these games stand alone. And I think it's fantastic they're 2 weeks after the Olympics. But yeah, I think, you know, there's been an incredible movement, I think, after London regarding disability in general. And I think a lot of credit has to go to the media for that. You know, guys like Adam Hills and the Last Leg team have really gone beyond what, you know, I think what broadcasters do, and really, really brought para sport to life in the, you know, the characters that sit within that sport. So, you know, I'm hugely grateful to for those guys for kind of shining a light on what we do.
Chris, what was I mean, you had an incredible race, and then it must have been heartbreaking to see that the Dutch ended up with the gold medal.
Yeah, it was. Like I said, we put so much into this. So yeah, like, we are disappointed with the silver medal. No, I think, you know, we might look back on it next week and we're buzzing with it. But yeah, we're a bit, you know, we're devastated. Mm-hmm. We've done, like we say, a world record, massive PB for us, and we're like, oh, you know, that should be it. And then they went on and broke it and then beat us in the finals.